stick to the time allocated and or spend less. Something that I normally don't do, I have been told I must do it because even Madiba said whenever he comes to a meeting, he always had to introduce himself because he didn't want to assume that he is known. I am even not known at all. So my name is Jabu Mahlangu. I'm chairing the committee. I have members on my right hand side. I'm going to request each member to introduce themselves. And then from there, we continue to introduce ourselves, all of ourselves. Madam Sotetsi.
I'm Dikiriti Sotetsi, member of the committee.
Nobuzo Landungeni, member of the committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Marion Shin.
Morning all. Cameron McKenzie.
Proceed, sir.
Good morning, Andrew Barden, sir, from Vodacom.
Good morning, Lal Maru from Vodacom.
Good morning, Albert from PMG.
Good morning, I'm Yolandi van Afrechen with the Office of the Chief Special Advisor.
Good morning, my name is Paman Damcheta from Centec.
Good morning, Sunaid Adams, Centec.
Morning, Tado Togo, Centec.
Morning, Cynthia Lisuzzi, Department of Telecommunication and Postal Service.
Morning, Honorable Chairperson. My name is Mameto Masamala from DTPS.
Morning, Honorable Chair, Alf Wills, DTPS.
Good morning, Frank Jenkins from Parliament Legal Services.
She appears to be so shy, yet they write so hard. Sorry? No, no, she did.
She was speaking from.
She did speak. I heard her. She's from her company.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. My name is Tsonga Mukumba. I'm here representing the SOS Coalition and Media Monitoring Africa. Thank you.
Moi, we have introduced everyone. Now, the lady is from Daily Maverick. They write very hard, but she speaks extremely soft. Hajira, did you introduce yourself?
Hajira Sari, Media Section.
Where is the IT person? Because, you see, this mic is not proper, the DJ's mic. And I don't know why the DJ is being sabotaged, because he'll be speaking for the whole day. So let them attend to this mic. I don't like it. Colleagues, I must also apologize for this room. It's only today that we'll be using this room. We can't use the room that we were using yesterday, which is a much more comfortable, much more open, beautiful seats. But we'll go there on Thursday and Friday. So apologies for this room today. That's all we have. Parliament is a very an affording institution. We, at this point, I should deal with other matters, that is the issue of apologies. The minister has apologized. She was meant to come to this meeting. She actually had committed to be in the meeting. I think I did say, did I say yesterday? Yes. She and the DG were supposed to be here, so the DG is here. The minister had to go. Apparently, there is a meeting of SABC. SABC is appearing, I assume, before the our sister committee, which we have split the two committees for now. So they are appearing on the communications meeting. So she had to rush there. And she then apologized, whereas her plan was that she was going to be with us. So we have accepted the apology of the minister. Is there any other apology here? No apology. I assume Judy is coming. I don't. Judy could have gone to E249, you know. A mistake can always happen. Just check on Judy. Once I'm on Julie matter, and I know that it would have been better if I say it in her presence. She is only attending Atin today, but I think I'll announce it later in the afternoon. She's going for a very serious operation. If I had things my way, I would have said she must not attend for the whole week, because she needs to rest before that op. You know, when you go for an op, you need to rest sufficiently. But she, knowing Julie and her commitment to hard work, she will come. But like I said, I will just ask us to keep her in our prayers as she go into that operation. But perhaps we'll say it in her presence when she's here. I hope she doesn't feel offended about it. Yeah, but we'll discuss it later. I mean, not discuss it, but just reflect on it later in the day. And that accounts for the things that we needed to do. One of the things I wanted us to do in the morning was a little to do a reflection on yesterday's proceedings. But I am going to request that we keep that matter in abeyance, if needs be, if members don't mind. And perhaps let's see on Thursday morning when we start, so that at least all of us as MPs, because I've not alerted how it was going to unfold. I just want us all to just in brief, 2 minutes, just reflection on the things that we are picking up. We are not taking a particular posture. We are just regurgitating what we are picking up from the presenters. Because indeed we'll put our positions once we have our formal engagement post the hearings. But I think that's just the things I'd like us. I don't want the chair to be the one who speaks on those matters. That all of us want to just do a reflection on what are the things that we are picking up, and then we can all agree or disagree. Doesn't matter. And then in that discussion, Mr. McKenzie will also indicate that he would like to visit Moscow, and so on and so on.
In January.
Yeah. Okay. Or is it Cuba or Moscow, between the two places? Okay. Good. Now we will start with our first presentation for the day. Centec is the name. All of the representatives of Centec have already introduced themselves. I'm going to ask them to start their presentation. How much time did we allocate them? I know we didn't give them a lot of time. We gave them something like 30 minutes. Because it's an entity that belongs to, that accounts to us. So, and their presentation, I mean, their input is also quite beautifully focused. And so, your 30 minutes start now. Sir.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Thank you, members. I'll be quite brief in regards to the Centec submission as outlined by the points of discussion in the room. Starting with an issue relating to the requirement of the one in terms of equity. Centec advocates simply that in order to be consistent with Section 9(2)(b) of the Act, the requirement for equity should not only be in relation to the consortium or at that particular level, should also scale down to the individual members making up the consortium in that particular point. We believe that will be generally be consistent with the preamble of the Act. Secondly, Centec is generally of the view that the Act as it stands empowers the minister invariably for the formation of the one, as can be seen in relation to the policy directions for the unassigned high demand spectrum, and therefore we do not believe there's any particular requirement in relation to the amendment of the Act for the formation of the one. In particular, in that particular point, we invariably advocating for the omission of particular aspect as identified there, as we are saying that the Section 3 of the Act is very clear in terms of to what extent the minister can make on issues of policy direction. In this particular point, in relation to regulating or prescribing wholesale rates for the one, Centec proposes that the one should be given sufficient time in order to find its fit before the regulator is empowered to initiate that market process that will then basically lead up to the regulations of the one or in relation to prescription of the wholesale rates. Our view in this particular point is simply that if the rates are prescribed too soon, it will not necessarily have the intended impact as outlined in the preamble of the Act. In this particular point, there's an aspect in relation to the bill relating to how obligations should be assigned in relation to entities to be assigned unassigned high demand spectrum. Our challenge in this particular point is that the Act does not really clarify issues of entities which are not necessarily financially within the same status. It's almost presented as if by being assigned unassigned high demand spectrum, invariably everyone should get the same obligation in that particular point. So we are invariably saying that the obligation should be commensurate to the market value or to the size of the entity, invariably addressing the issues of affordability. In this, the aspect in relation to spectrum trading, we are saying that when you consider other legislation, in particular the Competition Act, it sort of brings about the issue of it might lead or be interpreted as a measure. So it's not clear whether that is what the intention of the amendments in the bill was stating. But invariably, issues of spectrum trading, since spectrum dependent equipment are also linked to your to actually spectrum licenses, there's a clear link of the two. So we are of the view that this will not only go through ICASA process, but will also invariably beyond that go through the Competition Act for approval. And then the other aspect we would like to be considered in relation to the Act as it stands empowers spectrum sharing. And then we are simply saying that the bill should accommodate scenarios whereby if two entities are sharing spectrum and one of the entities want to trade, the owners want to trade the spectrum, there should be consideration for such agreement in that particular point, as highlighted, because there might be unintended negative impact. So invariably, the proposal we are providing is simply to say that IGASA should be empowered to look beyond some of the aspects in relation to spectrum trading, especially where in incidences where the Act empowers spectrum leasing and also spectrum sharing. The other aspect we like to re-emphasize is on the issue of spectrum refarming. We posit that it is neither an allocation nor an assignment issue. It's simply repurposing of spectrum. So the view is that as this is an operational aspect, we do not necessarily support the need for approval in terms of the regulator, because at times it might negate some of the intended use and or intended purposes when it comes to issues of spectrum refarming. That is the end of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is there any addition from Centec? Ian. Colleagues, that's the presentation from Centec. Any takers? Madam Shane? You are the only person who's going to speak on Centec.
Thank you. I think most of it is sort of reasonably technical in nature that we can sort of entertain. But one thing that concerned me on page 7 of your written submission, you say that you want section 19AF removed. Now I've lost it on here. Talks about, sorry. You say that are you wanting the WON to be a state-owned entity? Because that's what I interpret from the 19AF. Says that the wireless open access network licensee, section F, may not be a public entity under the Public Finance Management Act. So are you saying that the that the WON should be an SOE? And if so, why?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair. Centec is not advocating that the WON should be a state-owned entity. Invariably, what we are advocating for is the opportunity to be part of the WON. Invariably, we believe this section, even if the WON is not a state-owned entity, it might also hinder state-owned entities to form part of the consortium for the WON. So that is our interpretation.
So are you saying that you want the freedom, Centec wants the freedom to become a customer of the WON, or are you wanting to actually get spectrum yourself?
Centec is asking for the freedom to be part of the consortium, invariably, which like to lead that as part of the consortium, also an allocation of the spectrum within the consortium.
Centec is going to be part of the 200.
Hang on. In previous discussions on the WON, we've had from the minister that absolutely none of the SOEs will be members of the WON. Absolutely none. So are you saying that there's been a policy change? Or are you hoping there will be a policy change?
No.
You're saying, sir, from what I understand, that he actually wanted to be...
They would want us to legislate that we overrule the minister, that they participate. They have freedom to make their views, they have freedom to make their views. It is up to us whether we take their views or not. But yeah, you have the bite, sir.
Thank you, there has been no policy change. This is just our wishful thinking at that particular point.
You see, he's the same body as me, so I can easily understand him. No, I don't order. Order member.
Wait a moment, sir. And I can say that in that
way. I guess I don't think there's anything the department would like to say. Would you, DG and company?
No, thanks, Chair. I think the way we have understood it is that we have allowed the entities to also participate on their own and give their views on certain aspects. Now, what the bill says is that, the bill says that in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, it defines what is a state-owned company. And we then say in the bill that the envisaged one will not be a public entity. Now, an entity where a state entity has shareholding does not necessarily become an SOC because of that shareholding. So if any state entity, including the PIC, the IDC, and all every state entity may want to invest, that's a separate matter. But all what we're saying is that it cannot be a state-owned company as defined in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, even if there are state entities that may wish to participate. Let's say, for example, the PIC.
Thank you, Chairperson, and apologies for being late. Unfortunately, I'm going to be missing and skipping in between. I really have sort of to juggle my participation. Just clarity, if we're looking for investment in the WOAN, will public-owned entities, SOEs, will they be able to make investment into the WOAN? From funds, would they have to raise private funding for that? How does the department and the policymakers see, investment in the world? Thank you.
Chair, through you, it can take a variety of forms. Let's take in the case of the likes of PIC, IDC. We will envisage that they have money to invest. But if we're talking about a situation of Centec, Centec is one of the entities that has so many sites spread throughout the country. So it does have infrastructure that it can enable the world. So investment may take even the form of using a kind of infrastructure that you already have to enable the world, and then it becomes some form of equity kind of engagement. I must say that we have not discussed this matter with Centec, but to respond to the question, the ones that are DFIs can find go straight and be investors financially, but the likes of Centec may use their own infrastructure that they already have and say to the one that we want to be part of it, and this is what we're putting on the table. So those are some of the options that you can have. But the most important thing is that it can't be a state-owned company as defined in the Public Finance Management Act. It has to be a private entity.
Clarity?
Yes, thank you. I think that we actually, Chair, need to discuss whether it is appropriate for an entity that has built its infrastructure with public money to become part of the one. I find that a bit of a problem. I think we need to discuss that further, Chair.
We will discuss each and every aspect of the bill from the first page and the last page, and all matters that have been put before the committee. That's exactly what we will be doing. For now, we are just teasing issues out. We will have our date with the bill. That takes us to the next item, which is Media Monitoring Africa, SOS. Are you the gentleman?
Yes.
You are on the floor.
Thank you, Chair.
Good morning once again, everybody.
Do we have a PowerPoint presentation?
No, I don't. I have submitted the written submission.
Yes, we have it.
And I hope the members have been offered copies of that.
Okay.
Okay.
Your name, you didn't introduce yourself, did you?
I did. My name is Tsanga Mukumba. Unfortunately, Mr. William Bird was unavailable to make this appointment. He had a computer.
Tsanga Mukumba.
Mukumba, yes.
Okay. Mr. Tsamba.
Thank you. All right. Just to begin with, I'd like to introduce the two organizations that I'm representing here today. SOS Support Public Broadcasting Coalition is a grouping of NGOs, trade unions, community-based organizations, community media houses, industry representative bodies, academics, freedom of expression activists, and concerned individuals like myself. Media Monitoring Africa, on the other hand, is a media monitoring organization which seeks to help the media play its democratic information-spreading role by monitoring the reporting of media houses for media ethics, quality journalism, and media freedom. Both of these organizations tend to... Their main focus is on broadcasting policy and has been in the past. However, they are conscious of the convergence of broadcasting, ICT, telecoms, and because of this, they've been running multi-stakeholder workshops over the past year and a half to deal with general ICT internet governance issues, including this process, the cybersecurity bill, the critical infrastructure bill, and the like.
I'm calling for the department to be merged.
Yes, very strongly.
Yes.
And we celebrate the fact that it's happened.
To do that. Yes. You convince the president.
Well, we don't want to take credit for everything, but I hope we played a small role. Okay. The core of what I want to present to the honourable members today and the esteemed guests is firstly to provide insight into the nature of the challenges facing the electronic communications landscape in South Africa today. Secondly, I'd like to argue for a legislative framework that is sensitive to and capitalises on the reality of convergence of the telecoms, broadcast, and internet service provision sectors or industries. And lastly, I would like to emphasize the constitutional imperatives found in Section 192 of the Constitution regarding broadcasting and ICASA, and therefore, in today's world, the allocation and management of spectrum and the regulation of industries which monetize spectrum. So, firstly, I would like to look bit backwards into the policy history. It has not been the most optimal process, we would say, with respect. However, there is new hope with the merging of the departments. There's an opportunity here for the members to seize, to really reshape this entire process. An important part of the history of this policy development road, journey that we have all been walking on has been the initial process starting under the merged departments, the splitting of the departments, the various policy papers that have gone through, and now we sit with the bill. An important factor that we must consider is that the white paper which informs the bill largely ignores the consultation work and the inputs that came into the policy process thus far. Now, with the reunited departments, an opportunity to really embrace and re-engineer this process into an inclusive one that's comprehensive and takes into account the capacity, the direction, the potential in either departments coming together and offering an opportunity to take this forward once again. A very important aspect that I really want to emphasize that has been missing throughout this entire process is the lack of a human rights framework to inform this work. Access to the internet today is no longer a nice to have. It's a fundamental means for people to express themselves, to access information. What is the basis for enforcing universal access standards if we don't have a right to access?
So, moving on to the substantive concerns that Media Monitoring Africa and SOS have. Our real core issue with the bill as it stands is that, in our view, several provisions that abrogate powers to the minister are unconstitutional because of Section 192. Section 192 carves out the space for ICASA to function, its regulatory domain, which is broadcasting. Today, broadcasting is not just TV broadcasting. All radio signals are a form of broadcast, which means our internet is a form of broadcast, and therefore the legitimate terrain of ICASA. I can cite a few examples for you of provisions, specific provisions that we feel are unconstitutional. These are detailed in our written submission from paragraphs 4.3 to 4.13, and again in 6.2.4. Clause 19 of the bill assigns powers to the minister which must be followed by ICASA if we read it together with clause 20. This removes the core agency, the ability to decide how to go about regulating the converged electronic communications ecosystem. If the minister issues a policy and it must be followed by ICASA, ICASA does not have much room to maneuver in its regulatory framework. This is further exacerbated by provisions relating to, especially found in the schedule of the bill, which propose amendments to the ICASA Act itself regarding the regulation of radio frequency. All right, our second major area of concern is the WOAN. First of all, the policy basis for the WOAN is questionable, mainly because it's really proposed in the white paper, but the white paper sadly does not really take full cognizance of the ICT review panel report, which presents an alternative modality to how universal access and greater access can be achieved. Secondly, it undermines the horizontal licensing scheme, which was applauded when the ECA was first enacted. It tries to put forward a hybrid license, which is both a service license and an infrastructure license, which is not in line with international best practice today. Lastly, we believe that the state is fully capable of pursuing the policy position that was put forward in the ICT review panel report, which is essentially to have Telkom build backbone infrastructure and the state provide last mile connectivity solutions. The WOAN model is relatively untested. Yes, it has been put forward in Rwanda. Yes, it has been put forward in Mexico. But these experiments haven't reached fruition. We don't really know if it works yet. When we have a clear alternative, what is the rationale for pursuing an untested solution that could potentially have drastic ramifications for the market dynamics at play in the ICT sector today in South Africa? And lastly, as I said before, this is not the only model to encourage open access, universal access. There are other models out there which are better tested, which are in line with international best practice. And Media Monitoring Africa and SOS Coalition would really urge the committee to explore those alternative models. On spectrum management itself, the bill proposes several changes to the spectrum management regime, some of which we believe are flawed in principle, and some of which are unconstitutional, as I've indicated earlier on the abrogating of powers towards the minister. However, there is some sunshine. I'm not just all gloom and doom today. The incorporation of the use it or lose it principles encourages the efficient use of a resource, and we can only applaud that. Ministerial control, the level of policy direction and as a result of that regulatory shrinking, the space for the regulator to decide how to regulate the industry shrinks. That, we argue, is not in line with Section 192. And we argue that this would apply even if ICASA was split and the ICT Commission / Tribunal was brought to life. The capacity and coordination of capacity within government for managing spectrum is limited. We all know this. Is it rational to split this amount of skilled human capital that we have into various entities? Do we want some of it sitting in ICASA? Do we want some of it sitting in the proposed National Radio Frequency Spectrum Planning Committee? And then another body inside the department called the National Radio Frequency Spectrum Division. Is that a rational way to utilize the human resources that we have at our disposal? Also, fragmenting this function in this way has proven in government in the past to lead to things like fragmented policy decisions, silofication, all the horrible buzzwords that MPs know so well. So why would we push ourselves down that road once again when we can have a concentration of skills in the regulator to really, really regulate the sector properly and then let the private sector flow as intended? As I said, we applaud the use it or lose it and other spectrum sharing, trading innovations. Those are forward-thinking. They allow for efficiency in the market. And they also allow the space for innovation. And what more could we ask for, really? Regarding competition, Section 76 of the ECA is being amended for a second time after a redraft in 2014. The bill calls for ICASA to play a key role in the competition regulation of the electronic communication sector. But how will this work if the ICT Commission and Tribunal are in fact formed? Will ICASA still retain this power, or will it be transferred? Will it require a regulatory process in terms of department ministerial regulations? How would that pan out in practice? We must put it on the table that SOS and MMA are fundamentally opposed to the splitting of ICASA. We believe that it's unnecessary, risky, and it would lead to undesirable consequences. As I've mentioned, silification, regulatory fragmentation. We do have serious concerns about the state of competition in the electronic communication sector. We did a set of submissions on a set of submissions regarding MultiChoice's historical dominance in the licensed TV sector. This was a result of inappropriate regulation, let me put it like that. And with this bill in front of you at the moment, there's a potential to recreate a monopoly, a legislated monopoly nonetheless, in the world, which is hazardous. As I said, there are other models which allow for more flexibility. We can present written submissions on those models if you would like. I don't have them at my disposal at the moment. The envisaged role for ICASA in regulating competition in the bill as it stands is really onerous. Doing market segmentation analyses, market sectoral analyses every 3 years is a burdensome task. Yes, they should be keeping up to breath with what's happening in the market, technological development. And yes, they should be passing that information on to the Ministry of Communications. However, to legislate that they have to do a technical analysis of this level in a field which isn't their specialization, which is really the Competition Commission's specialization, is asking for trouble, in our opinion. Although, on the other hand, we do agree that greater cooperation between regulators is generally a good thing. Greater cooperation with the competition is a step in the right direction because it is the functional expert in this area, and therefore we welcome that. But we think that
unwise to legislate specific requirements of market analyses for ICASA, because it's just not the right body to be doing that. In sum, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, I would like to emphasize that with the reunification of the departments, an opportunity to correct a flawed policy development procedure has presented itself. I know you guys are going to be loath to hear this, but we are arguing that you need to scrap this entire process. You need to start from the beginning and come to us with a comprehensive analysis of what the electronic communication sector in South Africa needs to fulfill the rights to freedom of expression and access to information, most importantly. And as we all know, those are enabling rights which enable us to access further rights, such as freedom of association, freedom of assembly. And the internet is fundamental to doing that today. So please, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, hear our call to scrap this entire process, which is flawed, and the outcome at the moment looks to be unconstitutional given Section 192, and therefore it's an opportunity to have another new dawn, and we hope that the members will heed our call. Thank you.
We're already digesting one.
Colleagues, that's the presentation. Any takers? Mam Julie, Mam Shin, Mam Bab Mackenzie.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to ask clarity about two matters. The one is it relates to competition matters. You acknowledge in your submission that some clauses relating to providing for two institutions to regulate competition is actually good. However, you also now at the end stressed that now I forgot your exact wording, that there's a serious problem with that. Could you please just explain what you mean? Because from reading the submission, it almost appears that you agree with the suggestion. So if you can please explain that. And then secondly, you have made reference to the split. You say we shouldn't risk a split of ICASA into different entities, but yet you have criticism in relation to the dominance of the broadcaster, excuse me, it appears that ICASA was unable to regulate sort of that space very well. So on the one hand you're saying ICASA shouldn't be split, but on the other hand you have criticism for some of its inefficiencies. So please can you explain that? And then lastly, Chair, if you're saying there are other models for open access, could you perhaps offer such models? You know, where would you suggest would we find different models compared to what is provided for in the bill before us? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like your views, please, on what is public broadcasting in a converged environment. Because I am toying with this idea of, do we need a public broadcaster, or do we need to, as a license condition for people who use converged communications infrastructure to broadcast news, to stream news, that sort of stuff, whether it should be a license condition. So I just would like to sort of have some of your ideas on that, because, you know, I mean, we have seen what happens when you get a public broadcasting mandate put into an entity that then abuses that and goes under and all sorts of stuff. I think it, you know, perhaps you need to look at it in the new converged environment. You say on page 25 of your submission about that the WOAN would create a monopoly.
Now, can you expand on that? Because the CSIR report research that went into how much spectrum the WOAN should have said that it should have at least 20%. So if we say it starts off at 20% and maybe goes up to 35% of the population, that still leaves the vast majority of population able to be served by the other network providers. So can you please evolve that discussion on how this WOAN would create a monopoly? Thank you.
Yeah, bon, some longer. Would you or would your two organisations, thank you for the presentation, by the way, it was very, very clear, easy to understand. Would you, if the bill, assuming the bill is passed by Parliament as it is, with your amendments not included, and I kind of support your last statement, by the way, would your two organisations then challenge this bill in court as being unconstitutional? So would you put your money where your mouth is, basically? Then just on the market review, are you saying that the Competition Commission should be conducting market reviews of this sector and not ICASA? Or if you say, with ICASA's in-depth knowledge of the sector and the industry, I would suggest that they are better placed to conduct this review. But if they, given that the 3 years you think is quite short, if ICASA was to conduct market reviews, what would be an appropriate sort of time scale for them to do it in? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
From me, sir, no, thank you for your presentation. You've raised quite a lot of issues of unconstitutionality in the bill, and I'm hoping that those who are qualified to say something different may possibly help us out in that regard. I'm not going to attempt to get into that space. But what I find, I mean, I think something that I would have wanted your organization to deal with as advocates of a range of interests is the whole issue of transformation. How do you see transformation occurring in the industry? The second matter has to do with what you term, I mean, in your input where you refer to that the state is better and able to take care of the network backbone, especially in the rural areas. What are you saying? You are then saying in your urban areas the industry can render services and the state must take care. Is that what you, I'm just trying to understand what you are saying. You want an SOE to be involved, whatever you are. You make an example, for instance, of the post office as a monopoly. So are you suggesting that we need another one to deal with the infrastructure built? One would assume that you follow every aspect of the evolution of our country, the funding aspects and and you actually... But yes, I think just motivating that aspect by taking into account the economic impact and situation in the country, would you still advocate for what you are saying should actually happen? Now, as you conclude, you say, well, we should actually do away with this process. In other words, you're saying the status quo must remain. Is that what you say? Yeah, I guess just those clarities. But before you come in, I'm going to ask the department to
Well, the DJ was not here yesterday. I must orientate him. We are not necessarily engaging into arguments. We are not debating in this forum. They are making presentations, and what we are doing is we allow members to ask questions and not to argue. Although Mr. McKenzie was a bit out of order, I said, I like your view. You know, the last thing you're saying, I love it. And you have my unqualified support. That's implied. That's implied. So that's almost an argument. I mean, it's almost engaging on a subject matter which we do not recommend in this process. And so Alf has been very good yesterday trying to clarify, and that's what we need from the department. As from you, we want clarities on certain issues that may not have been well understood, and perhaps even clarities what you are trying to do by what you have in your proposed bill. Alf, you are not on holiday today, remember, my brother. That's the work day, dag van dag. So you shouldn't just be sitting back and say, wow, today the boss is here, so I'm not working. You must actually work more. DG.
Chairperson, thank you. I think on the last point of whether the process can be scrapped or not, the question that must be answered by all of us is whether there is a problem. Because if the answer is everything is fine, then this should not arise. But I have a sense that the people who are saying that the process must be scrapped, they do concede that there are challenges in the sector. Now, is there another way of dealing with those challenges in the sector other than through Parliament of the Republic undertaking a process of this nature, irrespective of the outcomes? So now, our suggestion would be that we either agree or not that there is a problem, and that will then determine where we go. Chair, on the constitutionality of the bill, here's the catch, that after having gone through the submissions, it's not being attended to. What gives rise to the proposal? The proposals that were put on the table. Whether our own definition of the problem statement, again, on what leads to that, is a correct one. Because we can run for the prescription and debate the prescription to an extent of not solving a problem, yet the sickness is there. What is the sickness? The International Telecommunications Union separate three things. They have in the radio regulations what they call allotment. So allotment will be a decision on reserving bands or channels for specific services. So they will say, this band is for maritime, this band is for aviation, and so on. So that is allotment at the level of the International Telecommunications Union. Now, after that, the administration, the national administration, do allocation of the bands. This is for satellite in our country, fixed mobile, and all those kind of things. So that is done, it's called allocation. Allotment and then allocation. Then there is assignment, which is also defined as licensing, which is the responsibility of the regulators. Now, in our particular case, Section 3.3 of the current Act says that the minister cannot say who must get the license. So, Section 192 is in relation to the fact that the minister cannot make a determination on who must get a license and whose license must be renewed. So there is a difference between the minister saying that this band will be used for the following purposes, with the minister saying Honorable Killian must get a license. Those are separate matters. So the independence of ICASA in so far as it concerns Section 192 means that the minister cannot dictate to ICASA who must get a license. But the Minister of National Administration can say what the bands must be used for. So let's agree that that is the problem statement that we are grappling with. All what all of us need to do is to address ourselves to that and say, this is what it is. Let's clarify what those entail, allocation versus assignment. So that's what we're dealing with. Lastly, Chair, because we'll not respond to each and every issue, but I'll fully add on two issues. Where do you get a wireless open access model? I think we need to simplify this because we may be discussing something that is in our midst. Our understanding is that if you look at the fiber market, all the providers of fiber in South Africa are operating on open access basis. So whether it's Dark Fiber Africa, is Vumatel, and all those kind of companies are operating open access models in our own country. Now, what is the difference between the open access models that are being implemented in the fiber industry and this one? The difference is this: scarcity. Is scarcity. So because of scarcity, you then say that because here you are dealing with small, you could easily say you want everyone who is licensed and want to operate to go and operate their mini networks like is happening in the fiber environment. But because of scarcity, you will not be able to do so. So then you say that you want to group the little that is available so that it can be shared by many people. So the model of open access is already obtained in South Africa in a different context. But here, we're saying that we want to continue with what is happening in the in that industry. But however, because of scarcity of the radio frequency spectrum, then you need to pull together multiple players to work together so that they can build this wholesaler. So it may not be necessary, perhaps, for us to go out and say, let's check where else this is done. Lastly, check on this issue. The Sentech model has been very interesting because, albeit owned by the state, Sentech has shown that this country indeed does have such a common carrier model because Sentech is required, has always been required by law, to operate on non-discriminatory and transparency principles. To an extent that today as we speak, more than 95% of broadcasters, even the very big ones, are carried by SENEC. So if you ask me, I would say that even in broadcasting, we have perfected a model that even other countries are still coming to us to say, how did you get it right? So I've given two examples of how you can build a wholesaler. It is in the South African context, without even having to talk about Rwanda, because we may rush to want to talk about Rwanda because Rwanda might not have done well, whilst this country itself has done well on those issues. So, Chair, I'll ask us to just deal with the two issues for the sake of time.
Or perhaps a few more, Chair, because the Chair said I must come back. So the splitting of ICASA is not a matter considered in this bill, Chair, so we're not even going to comment on that part. There's a challenge on the white paper and SA Connect and whether it was properly canvassed or consulted. We'll argue that it was, Chair. And for example, SA Connect already started in the context of the one. SA Connect already started and clearly said the minister must determine the viability of establishing one or more wholesale open access networks. So it's already there. It's back then in 2013. The policy was already laid down. In this regard, it continued in the policy review process. Clear matters and discussion on open access. standing out in the one, in the white paper. Again, the minister carried on consultation from November 2016 after the white paper was released, all the way up to the drafting of the bill. Again, the bill was published and consulted on. So there's a whole history of consultation on the matter. In the submission, they make the point that at least three envisaged bills, or however many bills under the white paper, must come to Parliament at the same time. Except for being impractical, we say that's not the case, Chair. At least the three bills we drafted so far under the white paper, they're not directly interlinked, and so as to be dependent on each other. The ECA bill, as explained yesterday, can stand on its own, and it does. It refers and relates to the current ICASA as we have it, still respecting the independence of ICASA as laid out. There's also a claim that there's an absence of any rights-based framing for the ECA. But that, strangely enough, is exactly how this process started. If anyone can go, and the head of the PMO is here, the DDG is here, that managed that process where up front in the framing paper it was all about rights and what are the rights and which rights are protected and should be given effect to, and all of that was the basis of where we are, in fact, today. There's a requirement somewhere. Of course, this document or this submission tries to analyze each section in the bill and find an argument to say it's unconstitutional. So in the definition of broadband, for example, the current definition as we have it says minister must determine and define broadband. Now this submission says no, take out minister even there. We just don't see the point, Chair, because even as far back as SA Connect, in Section 8, the white paper again, paragraph 554, confirms the role of the minister in constantly defining and updating what is relevant and what's the latest definition of broadband should be to take the country forward. We, in fact, did the opposite of what these claims are. We've added a role for ICASA now to say make recommendations to the minister to help the minister make this definition. On the definition of high demand spectrum, they similarly say that the minister shouldn't play a role. We'd say that ICASA is also part of that process. The minister acts there in consultation with ICASA because it's a combined responsibility. There's a claim somewhere, it's just a technical matter that our sections are wrongly placed, or the proposed bill sections 29A and B are wrongly placed in the wrong chapter. That's not correct, Chair. The preceding words say that it's inserted in Chapter 5 before Section 30, so it's correctly done. There's a matter of saying that the spectrum audit and that should be done by the licensees, or the report on the spectrum use should not be given to the minister. But the bill provides and suggests that it be given to both the authority and the minister, because the minister similarly in the role of policy making, and the NRFP would require that kind of information. One or two more, Chair, if you'll permit me. Let me skip those and then go to just a final point, Chair. Towards the back of their submission, they thankfully support many things in the bill. They start in 351 by supporting the use it or lose it principle. They then make, you know, as I said, towards the latter part of the document, references to parts they do support. SOS and MMA believe that some of the amendments in Section 67 will begin to remedy the situation. They talk about removing the requirement in Section 67.4 for the inquiry is welcome. My point is, Chair, it's ironic that they say remove all of this and start over, take the process 8 years back, whereas at the same time they do welcome a number of amendments brought about by this bill. Thank you, Chair.
I just wanted to say, Chair,
I would prefer it if the department would just succinctly reply and not make all sorts of remarks about it being ironic, etc. You know, it's typical of legal people that they usually argue like that in court, but I would argue that this is not a court. This is a place where we engage with each other, and the very department will need this very same industry to make sure that we all make a success of whatever we do in the electronic space. So I would suggest, Jefferson, that we really reconsider how we deal with these matters. Just reply, say, we find this, this is the response to this, whatever, 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 but not make all sorts of remarks. Secondly, I would go back to the whole issue that I also suggested yesterday. We've just completed the National Qualifications Framework Bill. And in that committee, we made very sure that we kept the department in the process and that we asked them to reply to some of the comments made in the written submission, in written format, in written format. But at paragraph 1.3, this is incorrect. The white paper already referred to it in that. And I have a similar schedule before me because we're debating the issue this afternoon. I think that is more appropriate, Chair, so that we could get the department's sense of what is being presented, but that we do not engage on a sort of, and it's the same thing that Honourable McKenzie made when he applauded the presentation. I think we're in a fact-finding process at present, and I think we should try to avoid saying yippee hurrah for this presentation, or we reject that presentation, or this is, you know, so just a word of caution.
Madam Chair, let me hear you out.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, without encouraging any kind of dialogue, from SOS, they are purporting that the amendment should be scrapped in its entirety. And the response from the department was that the amendment exists because of certain challenges. So I thought they would be given an opportunity to concede or stick to their guns to say it must be scrapped in its entirety.
Yes, SOS?
Just the two fingers. For the record, and I'm sure the committee recordings would bear this out, virtually every presenter that has come to present, I've thanked them for their presentation, almost to a man. And in fact, yesterday I said how interesting it was to hear, I'm using man in a very loose sense, as the chair calls me madam. In fact, yesterday I said how interesting it was to hear all these different viewpoints and how this has been the most fascinating part of my committee work so far. So thank you, Chair, and I do applaud your presentation. I thought it was very well presented. Thank you, Chair.
I am trying to concentrate as much as I can, so when everyone in this meeting is, I'm the only man, I mean, most of them are females, so that's why I say, Madam, sir. SOS.
Thank you, Chair. Shall I respond as the questions were asked, or would you prefer a global response to say?
Global response. Look, as Madam Julie was saying, some of the things that we are raising that are almost contentious in the form, or that the department is, you have a right to submit a, if you need be, if you feel like, you can actually give us another, you know, appointed issues in the same way as Julie was saying, Madam Julie, that from the department we'll be expecting them to give us, and I did mention yesterday, almost to every query that is there, we would like them to submit to us a report so that we're able, as we engage in the bill, have the benefit of how the department responds to these questions. Mr. Sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right. On whether we're going to stick to our guns with the constitutionality argument, we are. It's plain. The regulation of broadcast is the domain of ICASA, not the domain of the minister. That is a plain legal fact. Abrogating powers to the extent that the bill purports to do is a violation of that plain language in the Constitution. Yes, we concede that there does need to be collaboration, discussion, a close working relationship between the minister and ICASA. However, the minister should not have the controlling say. It should be after consultation, not in consultation. So that's that point. I have the unfortunate luck of being the face of this presentation while not having had the opportunity to be too deeply involved in the drafting. So to some of the more technical points as were raised, I cannot argue, but as the chair has indicated, we will provide a supplementary submission to clarify where we were going, concede if we were wrong, because I'm sure people do make mistakes. So thank you for that. Okay, speaking to some more of the technical points, specifically whether the market reviews should be done by ICASA or the Competition Commission. What we were really saying there was that ICASA, yes, should lead the market reviews, but it should not be a legislated requirement that after a certain period, a review needs to be done. It should be a ordinary course and function of ICASA to produce these reports, to inform its work, to inform the minister. It doesn't necessarily have to be a legislated requirement. To allow for the flexibility, to allow for whoever needs to lead the process, to those kinds of dynamics, need that kind of flexibility ought to be built into good legislation, in our opinion. The chair asked about what we meant by that the state was able to provide backbone infrastructure and last mile coverage. The state is the primary duty bearer of all human rights. The state has a duty to ensure that we are able to freely express ourselves and access information. In today's world, that means the state has a duty to provide access to the internet. Whatever modality this may take, whether it's in the 1950s, states were expected to provide libraries. In 2018, they're expected to provide libraries and computer centers. In this sphere, what that translates to is that, yes, in urban communities, they will be serviced, so there is no absence of access. But in rural communities that aren't serviced, there's no access, therefore the state must provide the infrastructure. Whether it chooses to lease that infrastructure to a private sector entity, whether it chooses to run that infrastructure itself, which I think would be a heavy task and inadvisable, whatever modality it chooses, it bears the responsibility to provide that last mile coverage and the basic access, opportunity to access the internet. That duty rests with the state. The choice to go with the WOAN. We agree it's a policy decision. We disagree that it's the right policy decision. For various reasons, I think at the risk of potentially entering the debate, just because there is a problem and you choose a certain modality to fix it does not mean that that's the only modality. Or conversely, we're not saying that, okay, the status quo is fine. We're just saying that the process that has been used to try and fix that problem has been flawed. There's an opportunity now to correct that flaw. That is the bottom line. Why is it flawed? It doesn't take into account, it's not rationally related to the previous consultation that happened. Yes, the consultation is mentioned, it's acknowledged, but it's not given the reasonable consideration that it ought to be. In our submission, we make reference specifically to work commissioned by the department itself, by a firm called Analysis Mason, which points to the that point, it clearly states that the WON is not the feasible option to choose. That's work commissioned by yourselves. On the splitting of ICASA and on the need for the general, there's several pieces of legislation in the pipeline. We agree this may be a standalone bill. Is it the most optimal way to approach the regulation of the sector? Is the question we'd ask, to do it in piecemeal fashion. Yes, there are urgent problems that need to be solved now, but we need to be very careful about the process and about entrenching a way of doing things that could be suboptimal in the long run. Those are core submissions, and we thank you for the opportunity to supplement them further.
Good. Thank you very much, sir. We will expect your supplementary, what do you call? Alf, you need a break, man. Is it too early? Let's take a break. Let's take a break for 15 minutes and then we will continue.
I'm I'm a good friend.
Hello, shall we reconvene? 15 minutes is long past. Oh, is it not past? Shall we take our seats? We've given SACF a little break. The lady is not well, so we're putting her at the end of our program. We are bringing in Liquid. Now, Liquid has I had given them 5 minutes, and it's only later when I realized their presentation that I said I should have given them 2 hours. But now I am going to give them an hour, so they have extra 15 minutes if they have the energies to consume it. Liquid, welcome, and you are on the floor.
Chair, thank you very much, and thank you for the additional time. I'll do my best not to use it, because I really would prefer to be succinct and to give you some pointers. I do find it sometimes quite challenging in a presentation to try and take you through minutiae of drafting details. I think that our written submission stands on its own, but I'd rather give you some guidance in terms of our general perception of things, and also having regard, the DG just made the comment, and I think it's a very valid comment, which is it's very easy to criticize. And there is a fair amount in the bill that warrants criticism, but at the same time, we recognize what we're trying to achieve in terms of transformation. And there is a lot that's positive in the bill. And with some refinements, and I'll make some suggestions, we think that it certainly can advance the transformation agenda in an industry that's incredibly dynamic, but has missed the mark in a few places. And I think with appropriate legislative and regulatory interventions, we can actually refocus the industry and start achieving what we set out to do. That intro aside, my name is Mike Silber. I'm the general counsel at Liquid Telecom. Liquid thanks the portfolio committee for the opportunity to present regarding our submission. Obviously, the submission stands on its own, but we have some high-level views that we'd like to point to and to give you some guidance in terms of the written submission that's been made. A little bit about Liquid Telecom for those who don't know you. We're a leading independent data voice and internet protocol provider in Eastern, Central and Southern Africa. We previously operated under the name Neotel in South Africa. The South African business comprises the merger of the former Neotel and the Liquid Telecom group. And our business is to supply fiber optic satellites and international carrier services to Africa's largest mobile network operators, ISPs, and businesses of all sizes. We currently operate a fiber network from the Cape to Cairo, possibly because our founder, Mr. Masiwa, is Zimbabwean. He still fits and sees the value of the Cape to Cairo network when most people see this as a colonial relic. He sees it as a post-colonial ambition. And we currently operate the biggest cross-border fiber network in Africa. We've got a number of concerns about the legislation, and let me take you through the high level. So the first is the timing. And I'm not going to belabor the point, but in our view, legislation of this import can't be rushed. It's important, and unfortunately it has been working to fits and starts. We had the white paper, we had the draft bill coming out over a year ago. Comments were made, there were significant changes, and those changes are appreciated. I haven't gone in enough detail, possibly in the submission, as to the positive changes that came through from the submissions that were made by ourselves and others regarding the draft that was released by the department. But that being said, there's been almost a year with little interaction. Submissions went in at the end of January. There was a workshop that was held, and there's been very little interaction since then to try and improve the draft as it was into bill form. The department have been working obviously very hard internally to get it into the current form, but the industry has not really had the opportunity to engage. And in trying to be positive, I think there's a lot of issues in the bill that require industry engagement to try and find solutions, because it's very difficult in this very formalistic publish, submit, comment through the portfolio committee. It's very difficult to workshop solutions, and it's something that unfortunately has not happened in the 9 months or so since the workshop that was held. So timing is a concern for us with something this important. We've got a couple of structural concerns, specifically around independence in regulation, and I'll touch on, and we covered it in some detail in our written submission, the question of independence of regulation and the line between policy and regulation, particularly in the light of recent court cases where the courts have given some additional guidance in terms of specifically the ECA and the role of the minister in terms of policy as opposed to regulation and getting into the detail of how the regulator needs to operate. And then we've got a couple of conceptual concerns. And at a very high level, and this is why I said it might be useful to workshop some of these things. So the first is drafting new legislation to provide for matters that are currently enabled by the ECA but not implemented. And this is one of our biggest frustrations, is that large swaths of the ECA as it currently stands have not been implemented. We have not analyzed why they have not been implemented, and we're trying to fix the lack of implementation by amending the legislation. And we have a fundamental concern that all we're doing is we're just revising the framework and it's still not capable of implementation. So we think that we need to actually do some analysis as to why, for example, some of the competition aspects in the ECA as it currently stands have not actually been fulfilled, and why suddenly compelling ICASA to provide or take certain actions within a period of 18 months is going to suddenly fix problems that have not been able to be dealt with since the ECA came in. It came into effect in 2006. The second is the risk of excessive reliance on intergovernmental cooperation. Certainly the bill has significantly improved this aspect from the draft that was previously circulated, and the department's consideration of our concerns are greatly appreciated. But we still feel that there's a fair amount of intergovernmental cooperation and coordination that's required, and we're uncertain, because we don't have insight, as to whether the other departments and other spheres of government that whose cooperation is required are actually on board. I've heard some very positive statements from the DG towards this to this committee 2 weeks ago, when he was talking about engagements with environmental affairs, with water, and it sounds very positive, but we haven't really seen that much in terms of concrete actions taken. And in the absence of understanding and visibility of those actions, this is a concern for us, because there is the possibility that by placing this reliance on cooperation, it only takes one uncooperative partner to then scupper the entire process. The next concern is the amount of re-regulation required. Now, I've put a table in the presentation, not because I'm expecting you to read the detail that's in the written submission, but just to give you an idea of the amount of re-regulation that ICASA is being expected to do in an incredibly short space of time. So one of two things will happen in our view, and I'll go through this in a little more detail. Either ICASA will fail and lose credibility, and that's not what we want to do. We want a credible regulator that the industry respects, that the department respects, that this portfolio committee respects, because they honor their commitments and they deliver quality work. And putting them under undue pressure, in our view, is not the way to actually enable ICASA to fulfill its mandate and to become or to remain and enhance its reputation as a credible independent regulator in this industry. The other option is that ICASA rushes everything. So the first option, ICASA rushes everything and quality goes down. The other option is ICASA doesn't fulfill its obligations and loses credibility there. The third option, of course, is that ICASA is so significantly resourced that it has platoons of lawyers and economists and policy experts who are able to fulfill all of these objectives within the very tight timelines that have been envisaged. Now, that would be ideal, except in the current financial environment, I think that's extremely unlikely that Treasury is going to allow the department to triple or quadruple ICASA's budget to allow it to actually hire all these people. Then it actually needs to go through the process of hiring them, getting them into office, and getting them to work. So we have a concern that we're giving ICASA huge amounts of work and we're setting them up for failure. And to us, that's not an ideal situation. You know, we can knock ICASA for some of its, some things that haven't been done over the years, but on the whole, they're a credible organization that delivers quality work. And to set them up in this way, in our view, is going to delegitimize them in the industry because they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And that ties in with this question of lack of institutional capacity, particularly within the regulator, but also within the policymaker, and the amount of regulatory and operational decisions that are moved within the sphere of the policymaker. And then that ties in, of course, with the appropriate separation between policy formulation and regulation. So they all tie in together around these conceptual concerns. So let me go through and try to address the DG's question about how do we actually change this environment. So in our view, we need an incentive-based light touch regulatory model. This is Liquid Telecom's view. It may not be the policymaker's view, but in our view, from our review of other regulatory environments, this seems to be the most effective manner, using incentives, allowing industry to regulate within certain tram lines, and obviously taking corrective action when required, but not necessarily getting into the absolute detail, because that turns into a very complex and lengthy environment when the regulator actually needs to get down to, you know, real operational details. The second thing is obviously access to innovative and affordable services and platforms. And South Africa has, through the current regulatory environment, the independence of the regulator and the technology neutral approach in the ECA, has been able to go through quite far down this path in terms of innovative and affordable services and platforms, but there are certain constraints, and any amendment should be removing those constraints, not setting up further constraints. We also need regulation that drives costs down, not up. And again, recognizing that as operators, as licensees, we have certain obligations. I'm not suggesting that we be given a free-for-all and we don't have obligations, but rather appropriate regulation to actually drive costs down. And in an environment where we are trying to drive down data costs, increasing regulatory costs seems to be misconstrued, because it's inevitable that what I've heard referred to a hydraulic effect or a waterboard effect. If you're pushing costs up somewhere, it's going to be felt somewhere else. In our view, the question of underserviced areas needs to be finally and forever addressed. This has been, in our view, one of the least effective legislative and regulatory interventions since the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And I'll deal with it in a little bit more detail. But this is something that really needs to be dealt with. And in our view, the bill recognizes that it needs to be dealt with. But then the suggestion is that the minister will set additional universal service obligations. It doesn't actually look at a structural reform of the entire universal service access obligation environment to look at ways that it can be improved, and I'll talk a bit more about that. So in our view, the market undoubtedly requires a restructure. Obviously, that shouldn't be through the creation of single operators who can drive costs up, destroy existing wholesale business models that have been developed over time, and remove the confidence of investors, both local and global, who are needed to grow the sector. We understand that, and I think the department has accepted that, and the bill indicates an acceptance of that, but there's still some additional refinement that, in our view, is required to actually achieve that goal. We need a strong resource and effective regulator. We need to avoid handling operational allocation powers to the executive. We've got to retain the discipline of international best practice in spectrum management. avoid unintended consequences through a comprehensive regulatory impact assessment. And I can't stress that enough. We're really concerned that this water board effect has not been considered. People have come up with conceptually sound ideas and interventions to change the market structure. But what we have not seen is a proper impact assessment to understand what the impact of that will be on the industry as a whole. And what sounds great over here may very well have a negative effect in other aspects of the industry, and we haven't done a full analysis of that. And the CSIR report that was done very clearly disclaims the fact that it hasn't analyzed any of those issues. We also then need clarity on the exercise of access rights. The bill certainly takes additional steps to move that forward, but in our view, not quite enough. So when I was talking about re-regulation and capacity, and I know that you can't read the slide and I'm not expecting you to read it, the point that I was making is this is an indication of re-regulation that is required in terms of the bill. 6 months after a policy direction, 12 months of commencement of the section, another 12 months, there is a fortune of work that ICASA is going to be expected to perform. And either they won't be able to do it, or they will not be able to do it adequately, and it will be subject to challenge, or they need the resources to do it. But in our view, taking this amount of work and imposing it on the regulator means that something's got to give. And either the regulator needs to be adequately resourced to manage it all, or we need to be more realistic in terms of the timing and the expectations. I touched on the question of a regulatory impact assessment, and our understanding is that the 2012 RIIA guidelines are still in effect. There was a perfunctory RIIA that was done around the time of the white paper, but it doesn't actually address the regulatory impact assessment relating specifically to the bill. And in our view, this is essential in a sector that is this important to the economy. And when the aims and objectives of the bill are laudable, we understand, we accept, and we agree with the ideas of driving down data costs, improving access to communication, and achieving transformation in the industry through allowing new operators and bringing in previously disadvantaged members of the community as operators, not merely as passive shareholders in empowerment schemes, but actually changing the face of the telecommunications industry. Those are all laudable. And I know that might sound a little bit strange from a white male over here, but that really is part of our ethos as Liquid Telecom, is actually connecting Africa using world-class technology. And so we're fully committed to the objectives. But our concern, as I've mentioned previously, and I'm sorry that I'm stressing it, is that we actually need to do a comprehensive regulatory impact assessment to understand what the full impact will be of the interventions that are being proposed. And in our view, this is not a delaying tactic, certainly not from our perspective, but rather to ensure that what we have actually will achieve the objectives that are intended, because those objectives are ones that we associate ourselves with and are ones that we agree with. I've touched on the question of separation between policy and regulation. I made mention of the ETV court case, where the court indicated that ICASA is given regulation-making powers, the minister is given no regulatory powers and cannot make binding determinations. It's very fortunate that the minister in that case was also a woman, so I didn't need to play any sort of linguistic gymnastics to recognize the fact that we now again have a woman leading our communications ministry, and hopefully will serve with equal or greater distinction as Minister Motsepe Kasiburi. But the reality is that we need to understand the separation of powers between policy and regulation, and we're very concerned that in trying to drive progress, and we understand the thinking behind this, we're under no misconception that this is some power grab, but it's an attempt to move things forward which sometimes are stuck. The reason why some things are stuck is because there's inadequate capacity within the regulator. There's inadequate impact assessments done in terms of the overall objectives of regulation and policy. And our view is that by running the proper regulatory impact assessment and setting clearer objectives will then allow the regulator to work more efficiently and more effectively. But our concern is by trying to drive the process forward, and we see this as really a positive attempt by the department and by the minister to make things happen rather than having things stuck in a regulatory morass. But unfortunately, there may be a legal issue with that, and we think it can be done more effectively by providing capacity to the regulator and clearer directions with a clear impact assessment. So some specific comments, and I'll try and keep these brief. On the definition section, we're a little concerned there that in some very benign looking definitions, there's an increase in ministerial power. We've raised the question why we suddenly in a technology-neutral piece of legislation introduce a new category of license, the wireless open access network service license, as opposed to just recognizing that as a conventional ECNS with certain specific characteristics. For example, Broadband InfraCo doesn't have a open access network service license, it has an ECNS, and within its creation and within its licensing process had certain tramlines and parameters set for it. So we're not really sure why we need a new category of license over here, which is likely to be a one-off. To us that just seems to be contrary to legislative best practice to legislate for one specific entity in a law of general application. In terms of the objects, this is ties in with the question of regulatory impact assessment. We agree completely with services-based competition, but we fail to understand why infrastructure competition is becoming almost a swear word in this market. There's reference to concentration of electronic communications infrastructure, but it's not really clear whether the concentration is relating to the limited number of infrastructure competitors, which we don't agree actually exists, because the infrastructure market at the moment is very competitive, or if it relates to geographic concentration. And there is a greater concern because there's a concentration in high volume, high value metropolitan areas, and unfortunately a lot of areas of the country are underserved. But by referring generically to concentration and without actually separating what concentration we're trying to address and where the concern lies, there is the possibility of a woe being created to address what's seen as a market concentration rather than a geographic concentration. And what they'll do is they'll just build another network in high-value, high-volume urban areas, and the currently unaddressed sectors of the country will remain unaddressed for many years to come, because unfortunately the reality, and we know as Liquid having been the SNO as coming into the market rather late, we know that it's incredibly difficult to build out to underserviced areas because you need to build the basis of your balance sheet in high-value urban areas, and then once your balance sheet is strong, you're able to expand.
we don't really see the Warren being any different, and there's no indication. And again, the absence of any sort of financial modeling in the CSR report, the absence of a regulatory impact assessment, does not give us any comfort that the Warren will actually address this question of geographic concentration. And instead, it looks to us like it's simply adding an additional operator who will go after the same markets that are currently being addressed by multiple operators. In an environment where, in our opinion at least, infrastructure competition is very vibrant. You only need to look at the number of wireless roaming deals that have been announced in the last few months. Rain with its various customers. Telkom, Vodacom, Cell C, MTN. There are multiple roaming deals that are happening at the moment. And so we don't agree that this is a market concentration. To us, it must be a geographic concentration. And then the legislation needs to specifically address that if that's actually the concern that's being raised here. There's also a suggestion around duplication of electronic communications infrastructure should be avoided. Here, I think, and we've made this submission before, we're very concerned because all of us builds networks for redundancy. Banks are required in terms of their risk assessments to have multiple operators coming in and out of their essential of their core facilities. It's not good enough to buy two links from Liquid. You've got to buy one link from Liquid and one link from Telkom, or one link from MTN and one link from Telkom, or whatever the case may be. But they actually require multiple service providers with multiple links into their core infrastructure. So duplication is not actually duplication. It's redundancy, it's resilience, it's what we require for our networks. We cannot afford as a country to have single points of failure, and this is something as Liquid we've seen in countries where we have a single cross-border connection, for example, between South Africa and Zimbabwe. We are building redundancy, because if that link goes down, if there is, and we've had situations where there's been a tanker that had an accident on the N1 near Polokwane, the cleanup crews arrive, and what they do is they dig up soil from the side of the roads to contain the spill. What do? They put a backhoe through our fiber cable. Zimbabwe goes down. Zambia goes down. DRC goes down because that's our core route. So we're building redundancy. Now you could turn around and say, no, that's duplication. You shouldn't do that. The reality is we have to do that because core infrastructure, it doesn't matter. You can't have even a rural area with one small little link which is very fragile, because as we bring people onto an information economy, we need to make sure that they have reliable connections. So in our view, you can see it as duplication, something to be avoided, or you can see it as actually providing the appropriate resilience and redundance that is required to ensure that we operators, our customers and consumers, have a more reliable service. And in our view, it's actually market forces that will determine whether infrastructure is unnecessary duplication, because I'm sure there has been some unnecessary duplication. My streets and my driveway has been dug up 3 times in the last little while, so I can tell you there is some unnecessary duplication, or whether that is actually desirable and pro-competitive redundancy. And then a detailed comment, which again we'd like to work with the department on, is the question around public consultation and ownership and control, where currently there's a public process around changes, and the bill seeks to change that process of dealing with ownership and control changes, which we think is unwarranted. Turning to universal service and access obligations, it's something I raised before. We support this idea very much. Our concern is that we keep trying the same thing in a slightly different guise and we're expecting a different result. I was here 2 weeks ago where USASA was lambasted by this committee. And respectfully, it's not, in my opinion, the fault of USASA. Yes, there may be some specific issues with a previous board or previous management, or maybe even a current board or management, I can't comment, that have exacerbated the problem. But our respectful submission is that the design of USASA is not fit for purpose in the current competitive market. The way USASA was designed was suited to the 96 Telecommunications Act with a monopoly provider. Now with multiple operators in a very competitive environment, we're of the view that this obligation-based approach is not achieving the results that are desired. And we're of the view that we should be looking at incentive-based and market-based mechanisms, directing operators to compete for subsidies to roll out networks and offer services in areas that are currently not serviced. And we've had a look at, and we'd really respectfully suggest that the department look at some of the reverse-style auctions of obligations that have been very successful in other countries like in Chile, where operators actually bid for those projects to achieve their obligations. At the moment, and this committee has seen it, process awards contracts for network rollout and connectivity to entities that are not even licensed. They have no incentive to maintain the network infrastructure once it's been installed. They have no other customer on that network. So it's a one-off, whereas when we build network, we would love to have an anchor tenant, but we then sell to other operators or to customers or to consumers. The way that USASA operates at the moment doesn't have that possibility of multiple tiers of benefit. And that's, in our view, has led to some of the dismal failures in projects, because it's a structural concern. Yes, there has been some issues around monitoring and evaluation and process, but largely it's the structure of the obligations and the way that they're being fulfilled that in our view have led to their failure. And what we're seeing in the bill as it stands, in our view, is not sufficient a change to actually lead to a different result. So we think there should still be a levy, but we think that levy should be used to fund operators in winning well-determined infrastructure projects, roll out networks and services in under or non-served areas. We can discuss that, but we need, in our view, to shift away from this obligations model and move towards an incentives model. And once that's done, we can actually start redefining this process, looking at international best practice. I've touched on the WOAN. We think that the WOAN is a really interesting idea. There's a lot of good in it. We note that there's a parallel policy process that's ongoing. We respect the fact that the WOAN license should not be granted to any current large operator or a shareholder in a large operator, but we do have a concern, and this is where RIA is necessary, just to look into the question as to whether an entity comprised of non-traditional players is going to be able to raise the funds necessary to build and operate a large-scale network. I'm not saying it can't be done, but I think it would be very useful to have the analysis done by objective experts before we embark on a process, the outcome of which is uncertain. Functional separation, again, makes a lot of sense if any operators do participate in the WOAN as consortium members, but the costs and operational requirements of functional separation are very significant. Operators around this room who have been involved in functional separation will know what I'm talking about. And again, expecting a startup to maintain the necessary functional separation is potentially, again, a barrier to the success of the WOAN. It also may struggle to attract the skills and technical know-how to actually build and operate the WOAN, which may mean that it's simply outsourced to a non-local provider, meaning that the transformation objective that we're actually trying to achieve may not be significant, because our expectation is that it's not just ownership of the WOAN, but actual deployment and technical operation that's critical in terms of transformation of the industry. It's not just giving a few shareholders the benefit of so-called transformation, but the actual people who are going to be deploying the infrastructure and operating the infrastructure. You've heard from Professor Gilwald. I'm not going to repeat it, but from her analysis that we've reviewed as well as other analysis, it doesn't seem to suggest that mandatory open access networks have increased competition or decreased pricing or stimulated demand. And again, this is, comes back to the impact assessment. Licensing should be carefully examined, and we really would like to suggest that while this process is ongoing, that the department in its policy approach engage with ICASA on what would possibly be a phased-in approach for the WAN, possibly using existing state-owned networks, strictly controlled pricing mechanism, clear rules on access and non-discrimination would allow us to get into WAN phase one while some of the additional work is ongoing around phases two, three, etc. Rapid deployments, in the interest of time, I'm not going to get into this in huge amount of detail. It's all in the submission. Our concern is that there are tools that have been in the ECA since 2005, and they have not yet been implemented, and there are various reasons for that. We really welcome and appreciate the fact that this is being addressed. It's no use going about what could have been. At least it's being dealt with now, but there is some concern about excessive detail and over-regulation, unintended adverse consequences about the so-called one trench policy. This question of adequately served to us is a little bit muddy, so we can't tell if it is of significant concern or if it just requires a little bit of additional clarity and work. And this is one of those areas where I indicated I don't think that just throwing edits to a bill is necessarily the best way of dealing with it, because I think some of these questions in terms of what is the harm that's being sought to be addressed would be better dealt with in a workshop, and then we can engage on specific language and drafting. Application procedure needs further detail, preferably in regulations and not in the bill. Dispute resolution, in our view, would be best managed through an industry process, and industry certainly is willing and able to come to the party to try and deal with some of these dispute resolution concerns, because otherwise it just simply places additional burden on ICASA and the CCC, which is not really the most efficient dispute resolution mechanism at the moment. Compensation, we really value it in the light of some of the litigation that you've heard about, that I understand you've been addressed about, but again, a little more thought in terms of how we deal with that would be appreciated. And there are some new structures and coordination that seems a little bit vague and could have a great impact, but we're of the view that it needs to be a little more focused. But in our view, a lot of this issue need not wait for the bill to be passed into law. We can start with these initiatives right now. And my request is specifically around this chapter is to start engaging more, because it's in everybody's interests. Landowners, private, public, state, municipal, industry, department, regulator, it's in all of our interests to make sure that the competing interests of all of these parties are respected and the interests of the country are advanced. We enjoy no primacy as operators, in my view at least. We need to coexist with all of these other role players, and in our view, the best way of doing that is not necessarily through a legislative process. In terms of spectrum, again, we've got some concerns. Ministerial powers, this use it or lose it notion is understood, but there's a lack of clear definitions. The exemptions seem very arbitrary to us. The new and restructured agency and the interactions between them are unclear and muddy. And again, the possibility of inaction through re-regulating and restructuring the industry is our big concern. Our concern is not that something is wrong, but our concern is that we won't achieve the intended objectives because we're going to spend so much effort in terms of creating new agencies and dealing with the disputes and the tensions between existing and new agencies. We're of the view that the high demand spectrum proposals are at odds with the overall objectives of the ECA. The timeline and sequencing is muddled. It effectively operates as a complete barrier against any current licensee obtaining unassigned high-demand spectrum for many years to come. And an example, and I've raised this in our submissions on the draft bill, but it still remains, is there is a threshold for obtaining access to additional high-demand spectrum of taking 30% of the WAN capacity. So that means there can only be three operators who get access to high-demand spectrum other than the WAN. So for a piece of legislation that claims to want to support transformation in the industry, what you're saying is three existing operators who have deep enough pockets to take 30% of WAN capacity will get additional high-demand spectrum, and nobody else will be able to get there. No new entrant, and none of the other major operators who may not be able to get into a bidding war around WAN capacity. You know, what happens if one of these operators decides they're going to take 60% of WAN capacity? That means there's only enough spectrum for one other to get 30%, and so there'll only be two operators with access to high-demand spectrum. What if somebody comes along and takes 75% of WAN capacity? Nobody other than that operator will be able to actually get additional high-demand spectrum. Now, that, in our view, surely cannot be the intention of the bill, because it goes contrary to the current ECA as well as the objectives of the bill itself. We just think there's unintended consequence in the drafting that has not been thought through, and we fail to understand why, having pointed this out several times, that particular error still persists. That being said, and turning to the DG's comments and requests to look at how we move things forward, we really welcome the progressive approach. Other than that specific issue around high demand spectrum, we really welcome the progressive approach regarding spectrum trading, sharing, and reforming. A lot of that is happening already, but actually creating a proper framework within which it can take place. And sorry, I should say reforming is currently taking place. The other two are not taking place. But creating a framework within which that can happen is a very progressive step, and it's something that we certainly welcome. But again, in our view, with the policy direction, ICASA could start work on that right now, because there's no prohibition currently in the ECA as it stands against those particular options around trading, sharing, and reforming. Well, I don't think there's a specific prohibition, but I certainly think that work can start to do the analysis, and it doesn't have to wait for the bill to pass. In terms of open access and competition matters, open access is something that we are firm believers in. It's certainly something that has advanced significantly in the competitive environment that's been enabled by the ECA, much to the benefit of the entire industry. But there has been but this whole approach to open access has been hampered by implementation. But because of significant infrastructure competition, in our view, it's no longer quite as critical, because you are able to get access to various open access networks in various places in the country. Maybe not everywhere, but certainly if you look at the way that our colleagues at Telkom have split their business and OpenServe, yes, it's their flavor of open access as compared to Liquid's flavor of open access as compared to DFA's flavor of open access. They're all open access with its own specific definition and approach, but it's available. And so we're not really sure that this issue is quite as critical as to require a deeming provision, which in our view is significantly dangerous, because it's trying to address market dominance and concentration, but doing that through services-based competition as opposed to infrastructure competition, in our view, is likely to have the opposite effect, and it actually will reduce incentives to build network redundancy. Our view of this deeming provision is not based on any rationale, and it may be an overreach. The expectation of the authority to complete regulations in 18 months is optimistic, given historical performance and additional changes that may be imposed on the regulator. The ECA, as it stands, allows ICASA to consider many of these issues without needing to wait for legislative changes. However, ICASA needs adequate resources to do so. And the market definition process may be a better process to actually look at this than going through a deeming process. So in conclusion, we're of the view that while the bill is a significant improvement on the draft that was published and has many laudable objectives that are intended and, if structured correctly, may achieve the desire of reducing the cost to communicate, increasing transformation in our sector, and actually driving economic transformation for the country as a whole, we're really of the view that more consultation is required, specifically around implementation. We're firm believers that if it isn't broken, don't fix it. Don't draft something new unless it actually needs to fix a problem, in which case, understand the problem and why it's there, because the fix that you may be imposing or suggesting may just be papering a crack that is deeper than that. And my comments on universal services, to me, is the most stark example over there. We really would appreciate a complete picture of all the proposed legislative changes. At the moment, this bill has been introduced without some of the other legislation that we were told would be introduced and then haven't heard about for a while, including the restructuring of the regulator. We really would like to understand the full picture over here and not looking at just one aspect. And we need, in our view, a regulatory impact assessment across all those pieces of legislation. This bill is an important attempt to improve the ECA, and we really welcome that, and particularly questions around rapid deployment, which has been unaddressed and has become a thorn in all of our sides, and a refocus on consumer welfare and subscriber benefit. It's really positive, and the objectives are ones that we align ourselves with completely. But we're of the view that this bill in its current form is not yet ready for prime time. More work is required, and we stand willing, and I'm sure that my colleagues, competitors around the room would like to do the same thing, not to delay, not to hamper, but to actually find workable solutions together with the department, together with this committee, to actually take this sector forward. With that, let me close and thank you, Chair, the honourable members, and those in the audience for your attention, and I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
Thank you, sir. So you also a lawyer, I assume.
I admit to being an attorney, sir.
Oh. Okay, thank you. When we have to engage in the processes of getting this bill, we must actually take the lawyers out. The lawyers must come after.
Or we take the Shakespearean approach, Chair.
Which is?
First we kill the lawyers.
Yeah. I can see that we almost everyone is bringing a lawyer. This is law, yes. Are you guys lawyers? Exactly. See, we're not lawyers and we make the law. And I think we need more non-lawyers to be involved, so that we agree on an approach and the destiny we're setting ourselves. And just ask the lawyers to craft our journey legalistically. Because you see, if you get the lawyers to negotiate a economic bill, so to speak, show whether we really will make the desired progress. Lawyers never agree, eh? On each other, to each other, honestly. because they say if they do, then some one of them may not have applied his mind properly. They can't get paid to disagree. But, like economists indeed, yes. Well, economists are always wrong, aren't they? Most of the time. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having all these economic flaws, misfiring of economies, and so on and so on. But no, thank you very much for your input. DG, I'm sure you have listened to our learned friend today. He's put his arguments. And finally, we must find an environment or a situation where we can really work towards cohesing each other and ensure that we achieve the objective that we have set for ourselves as a country. Without spending time arguing in front of the courts. But members, you have the floor. Madam Shin, Madam McKenzie, Madam Chitesi, Madam Mshaboa, Dongeni. Shoot on, Madam.
Thank you, Jefferson. Just one question. On page 37 of your submission, point 153, you say the WOAN holds the potential to skew investment decisions negatively and will potentially create a monopoly wholesale network. Can you explain how you see this being a monopoly wholesale network? Because the CSIR report says that you need, you know, that perhaps the WOAN needed at least 20% of the market share of the population to operate effectively or properly, with profitably. So how do you see this leading to a wholesale monopoly?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for a really good presentation, Mr. Silva. Nothing if not consistent. In terms of regulatory independence, which you raised as a concern, do you think the those concerns as expressed in the bill are unconstitutional? And if they're retained in their current format, would you as a company be challenging this in court? And secondly, in your view, do you think the principles of open access that lie behind this legislation could be met through regulated roaming deals? So with the costs of regulating, for example, termination rates or roaming rates, could that achieve the same objective? Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, I think the liquid lawyer is really meant for us lay people. The document is simplified. And myself being not a lawyer, when a person says the timing and stuff like that, what would be the most reasonable timing to get done with the document as we're going towards, you know, the end of the fifth parliament? Maybe the lawyers that will be coming again will be saying the same thing until, you know, what would be the most reasonable time to say we can deal with it appropriately and get done with it?
And Chen, I'm covered by Honorable Dikeledi with the timing. Can Liquid Tele please refer the underserviced areas need to be finally and forever addressed? How could you do, especially in the rural areas? Can you please be detailed on that?
I guess I will not be asking a question, but just a few reflections, and with the hope that the department will possibly come back on the matter. Just a comment, Babu Makenzi. You know, the way this lawyer was presenting was so soft that I could pick up that there is quite very highly loaded detail in a very smooth presentation, which is, I wish I can have him as my lawyer. You know, one time I got into this, we had some dispute we're trying to resolve, and we get into this lawyer, and I'm not going to describe the lawyer because they know each other, you see. If I just give the description, they'll say, yes, we know him. I've never felt so terrible being in that lawyer's room. The first thing, he didn't want me in his office. Who's this? What does he want here in my office? I don't want to speak to him. Is this your client? Is he your partner? I don't want him in my office. I could feel that this man is in charge. Now, if I were to give it a description, you'd pick it up, and because I then said, I don't know whether this person has a problem with me because of the color of my skin, or is it because of his deficiency, which I'm not going to describe. But he was so harsh, he can't convince anybody. This lawyer is very dangerous, this one. He can be a CEO of a company and still just smoothly sell his product. So even Alf won't match this man. I think the issues that is being raised here are crucial matters, DG, that we have to speak to, you see. And I think it is important, first of all, as a committee, just to allay the concerns and fears of industry. And I did make the point yesterday when we started with the meeting that there was always a complaint that the bill has been in the system within the department for a long, long time. So it's a complaint. But there's now a complaint that you are rushing the bill, which is a contradiction. But it's okay. But I did say yesterday, it was not and still is not our intention to rush the bill. We had planned to deal with the bill for the past 2 weeks because we had not received submission. So we were ready that there is nothing being submitted, and therefore we're going to be dealing with a bill that has got no substantive concern and so on and so on. It's only on the 20th that we got tons of document that we had to... We had two choices to make. So colleagues, you receive the documents, go sit home for the whole of December and do nothing and come next year. What would members do? They will first go on holiday. The first one to go on holiday was Mr. Makenzi. Right. And then they wait for the end time to go to the documents. So I then said, no. Let's use the week that we have ahead of us, including the weekend, to sacrifice for members to go to the documents. And which we did. And now we know the magnitude of the problem. And we all have different views. And there are times when I impose certain decisions on committee, but there are times when I get very relaxed. I relax like Mr. Mike until I see him in action somewhere. But it is not the intention, I want to assume, of the committee to rush the bill. We can't afford it. It is never, it's a very dangerous thing to do. Especially because we have divergent views on the matter. So we can't afford to rush it, because we don't want to be quoted in the court papers that we rush things. We'd like to be thorough. What we will not do is to abandon the ship. It is not in our interest, and we don't think that is in the best interest of the country. The DG did allude to some issues which I think he may need to restate, because when you enact legislation, you are trying to respond to a question or you are trying to address a particular problem. Now, we have not been sitting in their meetings between the department and the industry where they were engaged, but we can hear that they've been trying to engage for quite some time. But I guess it would be very good that the DG refreshes all of our minds to say, what is this problem we are trying to address with this bill? What is this question that we are trying to answer with this bill? And is the conduit that we have chosen to use towards responding and addressing the challenge the correct one? But he asked the question himself, the DG, and said, don't say, throw out this whole thing. Come with a proposal and say, okay, first of all, do we agree that there's a problem? To agree on the problem statement. Do we agree that we need an answer or a solution? Is our medication to what we have observed as a deficit is inadequate? Put on the table what you think is a better remedy to the disease that we're dealing with. It's a very fundamental way of addressing a problem. I like the approach. Because then you identify the problem and say, do we agree that there's this problem? If all of us agree that the problem is this one or two, are we using the correct prescription to cure the disease or to respond to the question? And then we put on our tables our proposals that says, we believe that no, one is not the best thing. It is going to result into these things that are not taking us forward. But we are putting on the table that this is the solution, because it does not help to say, no, there is a problem, we agree, but we don't agree with your approach. So those suggestions are very crucial, especially for the big players, and Liquid being one of them, because initially, I must confess, I did not know the bigness of, until I went through the document, then I pick up, wow. Remember, I only joined this portfolio last year, so forgive me for lack of orientation. But when I went through the documentation over the weekend, I could see that Liquid is actually one of the formidable entities. And that's why I increased their time. And I could even increase it with another additional 1 hour.
Only if I brought my CEO, Chair.
Actually, that's the person I need in future. When we start to engage in the finer details, we would want those CEOs, the people who shouldn't be sending lawyers here. We are not, we are dealing with law, but we are looking at the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is not the law issue. The bigger picture is addressing an econo or a socio-economic problem. And lawyers are not the best candidates to take us there. Apologies to lawyers. The fact that I'm not a lawyer doesn't mean that I have high regards for lawyers. They are like our doctors. We can't do without them. Our journey would be very steep. But anyway, DG, those are the issues. But indeed, the issues that are being raised here, the usurping of powers from the authority into the ministry, is raised as one of the problems. Almost everyone has raised that aspect from yesterday. and those that are coming are raising the same thing. And so does the authority itself. The timelines that you have referred to, I don't even think we need to go back to them, because the authority has also raised the issues. That your 6 months, your 12 months, so those are technical issues which I think we shouldn't even belabor them, and I think I can agree more. The practitioners are best placed to say, the 24 months, we have not succeeded in 24 months, now you're saying 12, it's even worse. You are setting us for failure. The constitutional aspect, indeed, I think this is one discussion that we are going to have until the end. And I think we will also need to have some other players in the space, not the player, not your, I mean, people, either your constitutional experts or whoever else who really will help us out of this thing, because it is going to be with us for a very long time to come. And I think we'll need a forum where we discuss, narrow down these constitutional issues and see how we can clean our bill and make sure that it is constitutionally compliant. Obviously, there are other things that are not there. In this bill, the whole issue of splitting the regulatory, which I think there's no need to really respond to it. Alf did deal with it earlier on. And there's an issue of a competition, and I know that competition is a very complex thing. It all depends which angle are you coming from. When the market forces kicks in, the supply and demand, but also could have competition that is induced, which actually is not competition. So I think responding to all these questions, DG, is something that I would want you to, first of all, deal with this issue that is a problem we're trying to address, so that all of us are actually being drawn towards almost to the same page, and then you can address the other matters after.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm not going to comment about lawyers because I'm sitting next to one who's assisting me. So, Chair, I think let me start with the issue of evidence before I go to the problem statement. As to, there is a reference to regulatory impact analysis. That's not undertaken. Now, when you look at literature of regulatory impact analysis, there are so many variations. But the bottom line is always about cost-benefit analysis. Now, to undertake a cost-benefit analysis, you need information. Now, in this case, if you need that information, you will go to the same companies and ask for information on how a particular aspect of this bill will impact on their business. But you'll also need to go out there and check how it will impact on people so that you can do a cost-benefit analysis. So on its own, undertaking such a process is very long. Now, the whole rationale around public consultation is to arrive at what one can characterize as a partial RIA, and not a full-blown RIA, because even by the World Bank's own admission, if you were to undertake a RIA, you will end up just becoming dysfunctional. So we rely on operators to tell us when we make submissions, when we make proposals also. So there is research that goes on internally within the department for the purposes of us arriving at certain positions. But equally, it's the responsibility of those who submit to tell us how this will impact on them. Now, that raises two forms of measures, both qualitative and quantitative measures. That information you can only get from the people who are making submissions. So it is equally incumbent on the people who are making submissions to tell us that if you do this, this is how this will impact on us. Because even if we're to do it on our own, we'll go to the same people to say, tell us how it will impact on you. So if it turns out that in the submissions that you get, that information does not come up
from the people. So people say this will be adverse on us and all those kind of things. But it will be incumbent on the operators to also tell Parliament in quantitative and qualitative terms how this information, how these proposals will impact on them. So that is the gist, that is the essence of consultation. So to come to say that this will be negative will be better if we also know how so and to what extent, and that can come out of this process. Now, the other matter is to go back to the problem statement. And it is not even an ideological debate. It is a question of whether transformation ever ends at some point where someone says that we have dealt with transformation, we're done with it, let's forget about transformation. Well, it may go to a complexity as to what it is, what is transformation, and in particular, transformation in the South African context. Our own view is that transformation never ends. It's a continuous process that when people get certain kind of things, they need more things. You know, people keep on demanding more and more and more. Now, it is impossible for any government that I can think of to can say that in a particular area, transformation has come to an end. It's a continuous process, and that is the kind of complexity that being a policymaker, you have to deal with. Let me quickly just add something that will showcase the complexity of policymaking in this particular area. In the Telecommunications Act of 1996, we took a position that no person other than Telcom, shall be granted a license to provide national long-distance telecommunication service until a date to be defined by the minister. Now, that was in 1996. What were the imperatives at the time? You remember that in 1997, there was the initial public offering where 30% of Telcom was then sold and all those kind of things. Now, you would imagine that at the time, this kind of discussions that we're having arose where people would argue that if you do anything to Telcom and allow Vodacom and MTN to build their own infrastructure, you'll degrade the value of Telcom, and then the sale of 1997 would not be lucrative and all those kind of things. Now, we went on again in 2002 to say, no person other than Telcom shall be granted a license to provide national long-distance telecommunication services until 7 May 2002. So, again, it was to say that the investment of Telcom must be protected and all those kind of things. So there have been lessons learned in regulation in terms of policy making. Whether at what point do you protect what exists vis-a-vis the yearning to allow the new to be born? And that has always been what government tries to balance in so doing. Now, in terms of the market, Chair, what do we envisage as a market structure? Can we have another Vodacom in the South African market? Possibly the answer is not. You no longer have a company at that scale, you know, a new company at that scale. But what we see is that there are emerging companies. They may not be at the scale of the companies that exist. But they are. Some are even providing services, trying to provide services, using what we call the ISM band, those kind of bands like what we call the Wi-Fi band. You know, people are trying to. And when ISPA present, because ISPA is the representative of most of these smaller companies that are operating, trying to do things, ISPA will indicate that the companies that we're trying to assist, they indeed exist. You know, there will be that confirmation that they exist. Now, these companies may not be at the scale of the big companies, and they come to us and say, look, we are trying to do our own businesses, but here is our business plan, here is our investment, but the only thing that constrains us is that we can't build infrastructure because we don't have radio frequency spectrum. So, Chair, the crux of it is whether the companies that the department is trying to assist do exist, and whether what they are asking for is rational, is relevant, it makes sense that we can do that. So that is at the heart of this the debate of saying that how do we assist those to enter. Now, if you scan through a number of submissions, it does not always come out very strongly, except perhaps the mention of Rwanda's problems, that there are other ways of really assisting those companies to enter the mainstream. I don't want to go on and talk about the USALF and others. So that is the kind of challenge that the department has been trying to deal with, and I think the ISPA and WAPA presentations will be very instructive when Mr. Dominic comes here, because he represents quite a sizable number of small companies. Lastly, on my side, Chair, is the time it takes to finalize a process like this. And there are obviously a lot of compliance issues that we ourselves have to deal with, because we have to get CRs that we shared with the honorable members the other day. So we also have to go through those processes, state law advisors, and internally within the government system. So the crux of my argument, Chair, is now, I would say infrastructure competition is not necessary in favor of service-based competition. I think the question is more about interests than substantive, in the sense that, far enough, we need competition on the supply side. But when we do our own assessment in terms of the degree of barriers to entry between the infrastructure and the retail side, as will be indicated in the when the smaller operators present in the form of ISPA, you'll then realize that on the kind of ideas that are here in South Africa on what people want to do are just so many to count, Chairperson. Now, it then turns out that the problem is more on the supply side of the market. So there is nothing for us to do to tinker the retail side of the market, because the ideas are there and they will be presented. So it's not to say that there is no need for a service-based competition, infrastructure-based competition. But the point is that the model that is there is such that it also lends itself as a barrier to entry for others. So we want to facilitate the kind of competition that also allows others to enter the market. And that is the gist of all what we're doing. So if it were to turn up that the industry comes to us, the big companies, when they present on Thursday and Friday, they say, no, Chairperson and members, in fact, we have a solution which we can even implement at the go, even before Christmas, let's say for men's sake, and say, no, in fact, this thing is simple. All these people who want to get access to our infrastructure, to do what they are supposed to do, this is the package that we are proposing. We are putting a package on the table of reforms, and this is it. If that happens, it will be up to you members now to say to us that industry, besides telling us how bad the bill is, has also given us a big menu to choose from. So we are looking forward to that opportunity on Thursday and Friday, where there will be some big bang that suggests that there are indeed other ways of doing what we are doing. And then you are our principals on the basis of that big bang that we think should be coming to the industry. We've read the criticism about the debate on the number of... Our play will be that let's make history, if it's at all possible, with a package of reforms, transformation, being presented to members of parliament, and on the basis of that, you will guide us on how far we go. Because the instrument, the bill, is just but one of the instruments to induce changes in a regulated market. But there may be other interventions that may come up. So my plea to the industry is that when they present, let's have some big bang of practically what can be done to change the industry. Thank you. And Al, you will start by apologizing, Chair, for his initial inference, and then deal with some specific issues.
Chair, sorry, before that, should I address the questions that were raised by members first?
You will be the last.
Noted, sir.
You are the boss, remember. Once you speak, the house will rise.
Thank you, Chair. So, as the DG said, I told the DG I'll want to offer to thank you for the guidance given on how to respond and give clarity without getting too excited, Chair. I basically agree that I can't match Mr. Silber, but let me at least give some clarity or at least the department's perspective on some of these issues. So, when it gets to independence and the court cases and how it's interpreted on the ECA, one should bear in mind, Chair, that these judgments interpret the ECA and the ICASA Act as it exists today and as it existed for the past few years and how independence has been crafted in terms of those laws specifically. But these judgments also, some of them also favour the department and state that there must be synergy between the regulatory actions and the policy of the minister. It doesn't take away from the fact that Parliament can define the nature of the independence of ICASA through legislative changes from time to time. We as the department respect ICASA and certainly that it needs independence. But at the same time, it can't regulate in isolation. It must be guided by government policy in our view. With regards to the timelines, we saw this submission on the timelines before. Can't recall whether it was ISPA or Liquid that made the initial submission. Even listing with a table, it now looks familiar on the screen, with all the regulatory actions required by ICASA and what it means. We agreed with that submission. So what we did is there were lots more stating 6 months, 12 months, things that the regulator had to do. We removed a lot of those, but we left what we thought are the critical ones to ensure the success of this bill when it becomes law. So, for example, if you there are also interdependencies. The open access framework in this bill under Chapter 8 is critically important. But in order to start giving effect to it, for example, you need to have defined markets because one of the matters to determine what a deemed entity is that it has to have a certain percentage of the infrastructure market. But if you don't know the markets, if it hasn't been defined, you can't do that work. So then it means when you turn to Section 67 and market definition, it's critical that be done first and quickly. ICASA said at some point, yes, it can't be done so quickly. And we responded, but why don't you start right now? It's an existing obligation and power under Section 67. Why don't you start doing that work even today? Then there would be enough time by the time this bill comes into operation. But be that as it may, another way of thinking of it is the President under Clause 47.2 has the right to put different sections into operation at different times. So and he acts on the advice of the minister. So, for example, usually preparatory work is done, and when the preparatory work is in place, the president gets advice to say ICASA is now ready to start with that process, such as making a regulation in 12 months. But then all the drafting, some of the preparatory work is in place, and then the president issues a proclamation and says that section must come into operation. So that's another approach of looking at it. But it remains in the committee's discretion, Honourable Chair, to take all those timelines out. There is a risk if the market definition example, it's something that must be done. It hasn't been done in full since 2006, and if it's not done, it's a risk for the success of this work. But at the same time, alternative is to maybe just make some periods a bit longer than the ones we've suggested to be more practical. Also saying that we've already said that we agree that ICASA must be resourced and it must be a real consideration going forward. On the USO framework and reverse style auctions, I must say, it's true that the law provides a lot of things that should just have been implemented, and that's one of them because Section 90 the current legislation provides for reverse tenders. It's just that it's not implemented. But that wasn't the focus of this bill, except to clearly link spectrum and universal service obligations, because we're in a time frame where high demand spectrum will be released, and it's an opportunity to make sure that those that get spectrum are also receive commensurate universal service obligations, so that those obligations can be achieved as through this mechanism. It has its shortcomings. It's had its shortcomings in the past, but that can be improved. There's no reason why, and that's what the bill also tries to do. It brings in more compliance audits and monitoring enforcement requirements in around Section 31 to deal with that, to make sure that USOs that are in turn, that are again imposed, are better monitored and enforced and audited. The licensing issue, I guess as lawyers we can sit around table and find a number of ways of achieving the same outcome, but the problem was when we first wanted to just force the WAN into a standard ECNS, we found it's a misfit, because ECNS licensees, any license category must be treated equally. That's why they have similar terms and conditions, for example. So you can't go and force a marriage in those circumstances. The one, as we anticipated, has some unique characteristics. It both gets incentives and it gets obligations that wouldn't apply to other ECNS licensees. So you can't simply say it's just another ECNS licensee. It has the characteristics, in fact, of what is termed a deemed entity under the open access framework. So existing incumbent operators that have certain characteristics like significant market power and controlling scarce resources would in due course become deemed entities. But it's a whole due process that must be followed. So eventually most of these large incumbent operators would be what is termed a WAN now, a wholesale open access network service licensee, as per the definition. But right now you have ECNS licensees that are a certain category with standard terms and rights, and you have WAN. And we couldn't see another way to resolve that difference by except to create a special category for it. With regards to the 30% capacity issue, Chair, of course there is a parallel process that everyone's aware of. So in our policy direction process, let me take a step back. So it was firstly, it came about due to certain agreements in the industry on buying capacity in the WAN in return for things like not returning a high demand spectrum and so on. But the debate was out, does it mean collective or individual and so on. And those, of course, now the interpretation started and so on. But in the bill, we've just included what we thought was that agreement, that it's individual procuring of capacity. In other words, 30% per recipient of spectrum. In the policy direction, though, which came after the bill, we could see that there's a practical dilemma there. So we included two periods. We had a first period, which was a 30% individual procurement, minimum 30% individual procurement, that could lead to the 100% problem. But we had a secondary period in which it would be 30% collective, minimum 30% collective procurement of capacity. Now, Chair, we do not want to compromise the policy direction process. That's not complete yet, but the outflow of that process may be useful for the committee to consider. We'll say we are leaning towards a view that it should be a certain minimum capacity procured collectively by those that access additional spectrum. Thank you, Chair.
Sir, you are the last.
Chair, thank you, and let me thank you for your, I think, very kind comments about myself and my profession. I had the opportunity of learning from my great uncle, who had a very famous pupil. Tata Madiba served articles with my great uncle, and he guided me as to how to approach law and people, that it's not always best done with sound and fury, but it's sometimes more effective to actually be a little softer, because people may be more inclined to listen to you than if you address it robustly. Let me try and address most of the queries, firstly from the honourable members. So in respect of the question or our submission that this could create a possible monopoly wholesale network, the very specific focus is wholesale network. So at the moment there are a number of wholesale initiatives that are currently taking place. And I think you will find, DG, that ISPA for a number of years has been clamoring for wholesale access and roaming on the various mobile broadband networks. And the possibility exists that in skewing the market around the WOAN, that it will move focus away from operators being able to gain roaming or other wholesale access to those networks, create a complete focus on the WOAN, which means regulatory interventions that may be required fall away. The business model that a number of us are looking at in terms of enabling wholesale access and roaming falls away, particularly around the mathematical inconsistency around the 30% that I mentioned, and which my learned friend admitted to, that it could create a significant problem. So that's where the concern comes in terms of the monopoly. It's again this question of unintended consequences. We're not suggesting that this is designed as a monopoly. We're concerned that by not thinking through the possible impacts, this could create such a situation. You know, members may be aware that ISPA's intervention in the ADSL market, it's about 15 years ago approximately, saw wholesale access being granted through that network, notwithstanding a number of initiatives, complaints lodged. There has been no similar intervention in the mobile space, or the wireless space, should I say. And that's something that could be done today. But instead, we're going for an initiative which will see the licensing of an operator and the construction of a network which may have a pro-competitive benefit in 5 to 10 years' time, as opposed to an intervention that could happen right now, or could start right now, could have started 10 years ago when the first complaints were lodged, but can still be acted upon. ICASA at the moment has started a process of examining the wireless broadband market, and there is a market analysis process that was launched, I think it was 2 weeks ago. Clarifying questions come to an end at the end of this week. Submissions are due middle of February, and there will be a process through that. That's an intervention which will look specifically at the mobile broadband market and may make certain recommendations. Doesn't require licensing anything. Now, let me circle back to that in due course in dealing with some of the other questions. So there was a question raised whether our concerns about the regulatory and policy separation is unconstitutional, and the answer is, I don't know. The concern is that there may be some of those that are constitutional, there may be some of those that are unconstitutional, there may be some of those that are just not good practice and lead to uncertainty and lead to a lack of willingness by operators to invest in an environment which is not certain because the process is not well defined,
or you're centralized and it's uncertain as to when that will come through. Because obviously a ministerial direction doesn't necessarily follow the same process that the regulator would need to follow. So there may again be a number of unintended consequences flowing from the desire to actually move things forward. And as I mentioned previously, I think the intent is understandable and to move things forward. It's not to usurp power, which was a term that I heard. I think it's a desire to actually get the industry going, because there are a number of people in the industry, in the public sphere, and in the private sphere who are frustrated at the delays and the lack of change that's happening. And so I think the intention is good. I think the consequences are potentially negative. And again, if I could tell you with certainty that it's unconstitutional, there'd be no need to litigate. It would be black and white, and the state law advisor would say no. The issue is that some of these areas are grey, and that leads to possible grounds of contestation and delay. And the ETV case is a prime example of how parties engage in lawfare using uncertain processes to drive delays that suit their objectives. And that's something that at Liquid we would never do. So we would certainly not litigate on the basis of an uncertainty to achieve delay. But there may be others for whom it would be suited, and they may embark on such a process, and that's the concern, is that by avoiding certainty, we create room for delay through that process. And I think it would be opportune to touch on a comment that my learned comment Mr. Wilkes made in terms of the ability to amend legislation to achieve a greater certainty, and the fact that my comments relate to the ECA as it stands at the moment. The problem is that the changes would need to take place in the ICASA Act, and we have yet to see a draft or a bill relating to the change and the separation of powers in terms of ICASA that would allow us to actually provide adequate comment on that. So again, we're trying to deal with an issue with a blindfold, well, with a patch over one eye. We're seeing the picture, but our depth perception is out because we don't know what other changes are intended, and that's why the request we've been making all along is give us the full package so we can understand how all of these things interact, because it's quite possible that the concern is addressed adequately in that legislation or that amendment, but at the moment we're not seeing it and we're not aware of it. So the question of open access needs to be regulated by the regulator. At the moment, unfortunately, so I mentioned ADSL. At this stage, the regulator took a very progressive step, which was to bring ISPA and Telkom into a room, and they told us, you really don't want us to regulate it because nobody's going to be happy. We're stepping out of the room, sort something out, and they walked out and closed the doors and came back in 2 hours later and said, do you guys have a way forward? And we negotiated a way forward. The regulator then blessed that because obviously you don't want to create an anti-competitive environment. So if operators are not able to engage around wholesale access to their networks, and again, at the moment there are operators who are doing it, so it's not as if this is now something that's not happening. Maybe it's not if not sufficiently widespread to achieve the impact that is being sought. So regulatory intervention may be required following a proper process. You can't have big bang approaches with respect to the DG. It needs to go through process, because otherwise there is a concern that the process itself may be flawed, anti-competitive, and subject to attack by parties who may have a need or an interest in doing so. That touches on the question of timing. And, Chair, to your points, as well as the questions raised by the honourable members, which is this legislative process has been in place for a while, and I do understand when parties have said, why is there delay? But what we've been seeing is interaction in fits and starts. So we saw the white paper, there was some interaction about it, there was some engagement, we had some debate and discussion. The department internalized it and came out with a draft bill. We engaged with the department, there was a workshop, the department internalized it, and then came out with this bill. The DG gave us a preview, he engaged with us, he discussed with us, but we had no opportunity to actually engage on the substance of what was coming out. It went, you know, the department engaged, then went behind closed doors, and that's in stark contrast to what happened with the drafting of the ECA. And, Chair, while my youthful good looks won't allow you to recognize it, I was here and participating in the ECA drafting process, which saw the creation of multiple working groups comprising industry, public sector, private sector, so non-industry private sector, as well as the department guided to actually look at specific issues and specific problems. And this is my concern, is that some of these issues, I'm not suggesting that the department has to draft collaboratively. That's not how it works. But some of these issues, where we're looking for solutions rather than legal language, would be better to create a working group that could provide input, that could look, that could properly and adequately workshop some of these issues so that the department can take it back saying, this is industry's bright line, this is where they're negotiable, this is our bright line. In between, there's something they could then send out Chatham House rules, drafts for industry engagements, instead of having to engage on the totality of the bill as it stands. There could have been certain chapters, and especially some of the more technical chapters, where we could have engaged on this, and I don't think it's too late to try and improve that, because I even go further back to 2002, where Mr. Wilson will recall we did that on some of the chapters as well, where we actually took those out, workshopped them, engaged to refine those specific chapters before bringing them back to the Portfolio Committee. So timing is a difficult question. It would have been ideal if we'd had this in place a year ago, because transformation in the industry is being held back. Data prices are not dropping in the way that's being expected. Our citizens are clamoring for change, and so we need to take action. My question is just, if we're taking such a broad range of issues and trying to address all of them, then we need to engage substantively in each and every one of those. And at the moment, with the bill that came out in the third quarter, towards the end of the third quarter of this year, the timing is very unfortunate, because it's meant that we're being hit by, firstly, the December break, secondly, with the upcoming elections. And hence the suggestion to try and not regulate what doesn't need regulation, but to address only those issues that are critical so that we can get them done in this Parliament, and to defer some of the other issues for a more substantive engagement with the industry. Around the question of how to deal and how to address the universal service access obligations. And again, I think my learned friend missed my point. I'm not suggesting that the additional auditing and compliance vetting processes are not good. Great. But the white paper talked about restructuring the universal service concept within South Africa. There was initially talk about moving and restructuring and reshaping, and then that's just gone onto the back burner. And instead we have a very specific universal service obligation relating to spectrum in isolation without actually relooking at the total structure. So our view is that universal service obligations should involve payment into a fund and then operators being able to bid into that fund to actually build and operate infrastructure using subsidies. And the reason why I say that is because if we get an anchor tenant in terms of the fund to build infrastructure with certain parameters, for example, that it must be open access, meaning Liquid can go and build a fiber route in an area that's currently not economically viable because ISASA is giving us 40% of the cost, we know that we can pick up some business to cover another 40% of the cost. And we know that our competitors, having built infrastructure, will take infrastructure from us to offer services in those own, in those same areas, which means people get better service, not just from Liquid, but from our competitors who use our infrastructure to get to their customers, because we don't offer mobile services. So we need to actually have the mobile operators who have the market penetration and the ability to sell airtime and devices and get to people in those areas. We need them to piggyback on our infrastructure to make it economically viable. And then we can actually turn something that was not viable with that subsidy into a viable business opportunity, which means that we have the money to maintain it. And we also have very demanding customers who will insist that we keep that infrastructure up and running to very high service levels, even though it is in deep rural underserviced areas. And that's our suggestion, is looking at reverse auctions and looking at operators being able to access those funds rather than civil companies who don't have the incentive to actually keep it and who don't have the expertise and the experience in actually maintaining service levels for very demanding industry customers. And several of them are in this room at the moment, and you know who you are. Chair, I think your intervention was exactly to the point. What are we trying to achieve? What is the problem statement? Is the medicine that the medicine that's being prescribed is designed to address a problem? As I said, I don't think there is any malice whatsoever in the proposals. I'm just not certain that all of them will actually address the symptoms as described. The DG made a comment about internal research. I would encourage the department to then publish it, so that industry can actually understand some of the thinking that's going on behind here, because at the moment we're not seeing it. And it is becoming very opaque. It required a CSIR report on a very specific question to actually get some insight into what's going on. And that to us is not helpful in terms of trying to engage. We as industry submit questionnaires to ICASA regularly, relating to our networks, what we have, what our prices are. There's a continuous process in terms of the ITU questionnaires that are submitted, in terms of ICASA questionnaires, in terms of compliance questionnaires. We submit multiple times a year data that can be accessed. In our view, we don't need a 10-year RIA. We need an objective RIA by an expert. They are out there. It doesn't have to be an extensive process, but it needs to be undertaken. And the CSIR report makes it very clear that they have not looked at any financial model, which means that their assumption around the 20% market share is just an assumption. And again, I'm not suggesting that the WOAN would become a monopoly, but that it would potentially impact other wholesale operators who are available. So let me deal then with some of the comments from my learned colleague, Mr. Wolfe. And again, I do apologize. Lawyers tend to talk to each other with great formality, and that covers the fact that I think he's one of the most competent people that I've actually dealt with within the public sector legal fraternity. So I have the utmost respect for him. At the same time, I think that there's some issues that are incorrect. So the first thing is around open access. So let me look at the question of the market definitions and the timelines and the timing. And I think that Mr. Wilts missed the point. I've got no problem with setting timelines. I understand that we need to actually get deliverables. My concern is imposing timelines on a regulator that has missed every timeline that has been given to it, that has had 11 years to attend to some of these processes, and then saying you'll get it done in 6 months or 12 months when they haven't done it in 11 years. Now, it's possible that they've spent the last 11 years planning and researching, and they're ready to release it the second the bill comes into effect, is passed and comes into effect. But I don't think that's the case. And so my concern around timelines, and I don't think that the President separating sections and staggering implementation date is helpful. I think we need a different approach, and I think this committee is the one that needs to hold the regulators' feet to the fire in terms of their annual plan, and actually taking it beyond an annual plan into a multi-year plan to say, these are your obligations under the ECA. This is the research you need to do. These are the determinations that you need to come up with. Stop looking at a one-year rolling plan. You've got to look at a multi-year plan, because some of these things can't all be done at the same time. And you've got to see how that rolls together. And that's our concern. Our concern is not putting a number, but making sure that the regulator can achieve that number once it's been inserted. And again, putting no number is not the answer either. You know, just saying the regulator will get to it when they want to will give us another 11 years, potentially, of no action, and that's even less acceptable. And that's why we'd like to sit as industry, who are going to be participating in those processes, and the regulator and the department, to actually brainstorm how we put together a regulatory timeline that will allow some of these processes to be finalized within a reasonable and reliable time frame. In terms of universal service and access obligations, I've touched on that. I'm glad that there are some minor tweaks and minor improvements. You know, in terms of auditing, we as operators, we just pay our fees. There's very little issue over there. Some of us, a small select handful of us, have some additional universal service and access obligations. Most of the operators, including the ISPA members, and there are actually two ISPA members in the room right now, ourselves and one of my colleagues across the way, but the vast majority of these ISPA members don't provide any universal service obligations other than paying their fees. So it won't be a bad thing. But the problem that I have is that there's no certainty around how this definition process will work. And we had a litany of errors leading up to the current universal service and access obligations, which are woefully inadequate and don't actually address market issues and access issues. We still find we're given schools to go and deliver services to. We arrive there and find they already have a computer lab donated by somebody else. It's a really inadequate process to achieve transformation. And that brings me back to this question of transformation. And I agree with the DG. Transformation is a process and it never ends. But respectfully, it looks like transformation over here is not transformation of the lives of citizens of this country by giving them reliable and cheaper data access. It looks like it's designed to achieve transformation in an ownership structure for a network that will simply replicate network infrastructure that already exists. We are willing to participate. We're eager to participate in OWAN as a consortium member, as a provider, as a supplier, as a customer. If we know it's going somewhere and providing services that are not currently provided. But if you tell me to take services from OWAN, which is going to take 5 years to get up and running, is going to deploy services in Cape Town and Johannesburg and Pretoria, I can start roaming on rain in a few weeks. Why would I wait 5 years to participate in that network? If you tell me that the WOAN is going to deep rural areas where currently I can't get because it's not cost effective, and using that model will get me there, then I'm interested. And that to me is transformative. Doesn't matter who the shareholders are. You combine that with real transformation within the shareholding, and then you get a double bonus going on. You then add to that actually insisting that we use local providers, local contractors. We don't just outsource it. to foreign companies to build and operate the network for us, well, then you get a triple bonus because you're building resources and capacity in the country. But at the moment, the bill in its current form is really thin on any commitment around that. And it leads to the cynicism of many of us in the industry as to what actual transformation is intended. Is it transformation for a few shareholders, or is it real transformation that can be enabled through the power of technology? And if it's the latter, then we want to be on that train. But we would like to make some suggestions, and we have in our submission, as to how to ensure that the train actually is a transformation train rather than an empowerment of a select few shareholders. In terms of the competition aspect, I'm very surprised to hear the suggestion that all of us who have high demand spectrum will become ones, and that somehow it looks like our licenses will in due course be converted into these new WAN licenses. That's not how I read the bill, and maybe I'm misinterpreting what Mr. Wilt said, but that's what I understood him to be saying, is that any entity with SMP will become a WAN in the wireless space. However, at the moment, the chapter in its current formulation suggests that all of us are deemed entities. It doesn't matter how large or small. It doesn't rely on a SMP definition. We're all deemed. And that's the danger of a deeming provision, is that it doesn't actually do any objective analysis to understand whether an entity has SMP. So we need to do two things. The first thing is we need to define markets. Then we need to understand market power within those markets. So the reality is, I have significant market power on a fiber route that I have from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth. I have significant market power because I control that fiber route. Then it turns out that actually one of my competitors has a very similar fiber route. Well, do I still have market power? Based on the deeming provision, yes, I do. Then it turns out that several of my other competitors have the same route, just via a different, you know, it's not a direct route, it's an indirect route. Does that change my market power? Well, in a traditional market definition, yes, it would. But the way that the language is crafted, it says I have SMP on my infrastructure because it's my infrastructure. And that creates a deeming environment where there is no objectivity, and even the smallest operators that the DG is so keen to protect in advance, if they dare to deploy any infrastructure, that becomes deemed as open access in the same way as Telkom's or Vodacom's or my infrastructure, the big guys. You know, you would think that maybe there's some pro-competitive remedies needed to allow small parties access to our infrastructure. But if a small ISP deploys a small neighborhood fiber network, that becomes deemed, because there's no other fiber network over there, and suddenly they have to give everybody open access, and they may not be able to achieve the commercial benefit that they were hoping when they decided to deploy it. I don't think that's what's intended. So we need to go through the objective steps. Define markets, analyze markets, impose pro-competitive regulation where problems exist. If no problem exists, you don't need to impose a remedy. That's the way that competition analysis has been done in South Africa for years, and it follows international best practice. This deeming approach to us is misguided. Let me just say as a final word, I think all of us as operators, large and small, would like to be able to access the WAN. And that's why I said I think that the WAN as a concept is interesting, it's innovative, and it can achieve benefits. But I think we need to go to what you were saying. What is the problem that the WAN is attempting to address? Is the WAN attempting to address the question of inadequate transformation in shareholding in wireless networks? If that's the problem the WAON is attempting to address, then let's say that specifically. If the WAON is attempting to address the lack of transformation in providing fast, modern services to people in rural areas, in townships, in outlying areas, in underserviced or unserviced areas, then that's a different transformation. And let's say that. If it's trying to do both, well, then I'm a little worried that we need to actually say that and we need to set the objectives very clearly as to what's the primary and what's the secondary objective. Because I'm not sure that you can achieve all of them at the same, or both of them at the same time. Chair, with that, let me again thank you very much for the opportunity to present, the opportunity to engage in this debate and discussion. And please be assured we're available to engage with the committee or with the department in an attempt to improve the bill. Our comments are really intended with the primary focus of achieving a piece of legislation which can actually fulfill its mandate of achieving significant change in an industry which is transformative. By its very nature, the technology and telecommunications industry is transformative. And I agree with the DG that we've lost our way a little bit and that we haven't necessarily fulfilled our promise as well as we could have. So we need to be put back on our path. And we're available to try and work through that process with them or with this committee as required.
Thank you. We will await your supplementary offering, if there be any. Colleagues, we are going to... Is there something to... We are going to adjourn for lunch. And then from there, we think we should relocate to closer to the chamber. Is there going to be voting? There is a likelihood that there will be voting. I don't know whether there will be. It all depends upon the people who divide the house. We don't have those people in this house, but we will have to relocate to V454. V454 is the old assembly. You get into the lifts on the left-hand side. You go to floor number 4. That's where we will relocate from 2 o'clock this afternoon. And apologies for the disruption, but we're trying to come closer to the chamber. And... for those who may not be present, we are trying to locate them, but because some people may know others and their phones, some of them are inaccessible, please help us to relocate everyone to V454. Is that all? Is that all? Good. Mr. McKenzie, you lead the way, you know me.
Thank you, sir.